Good morning. If everyone could take their seat. Oh, I'm sorry. We don't have enough seats. If everyone would clear their lap so someone could take a seat. I apologize for not having enough chairs. We don't have this very often where we have more people than we have places to sit. I'm sorry, what? I guess. I would like to start out. Oh, well, welcome, by the way. This is the Mesa City Council study session for Thursday, February 23rd, 2012. And I'm just going to start off. Thanks to all. If anybody presenting, if I fall asleep, I'm sorry. I have not gotten a whole lot of sleep the last two nights. Last night was incredible. And it was... when you're part of this, you always expect that something weird's going to happen, and it couldn't have been more perfect. Mesa just shone, and I have never been more proud of our city and our staff. Well, except for the last time, but I was never more proud. This seems to be a habit that our city staff and our facilities like the Arts Center just do incredible things. Thank you, Mr. Brady. I wish I could mention everyone who really played a significant role in making that success. That was not by accident. We had a lot of people on our staff here at the Arts Center, PD, fire, everybody came together to really work with CNN. And I will tell you, I think the thing that made me most proud, even before the broadcast started, was to have the CNN producers come up and start talking about their experience here in town. And they were just effusive in their praise. And one producer said, "We've done several of these things. We've never had a venue that was as perfect as this is. We've never had a city that worked with us as well." One of the head of the security said he's never worked with a police department that was as professional. And the one guy pulled me aside and said, "By the way, Mayor, we don't throw out compliments like this gratuitously." So I can't tell you. I'm still off the ground. Thank you so very much. Oh, yeah, and there was a debate, too. it was really great and showed what this community can and does do when it puts its mind to it. So, did I say thank you?
Yes.
Okay, good.
You're not flying today, are you?
Yeah, I am. It's great. First item on the agenda. Hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposals received. Hello.
We review the agenda when we go to Thursday.
Okay, thank you very much. Like I told you, did I mention I haven't had a whole lot of sleep the last two nights? Let's review the agenda for next Monday's regular council meeting. I am very lucky because this is like a bologna sandwich. I got two breads and then the total bologna in the middle. And whenever I miss something on the agenda, the vice mayor and Dennis rush to see who can point it out, and they're really good at that. They saved me on many times. Okay, everyone got it? Page 2. Items 3A through 3D. Items 3E through 4B.
Mayor.
Vice Mayor.
We're going to return 4B, the consent agenda. I had the opportunity to review the transportation ventilators. The fire department is not doing itself any justice with simply putting this on the consent agenda. Not only are they purchasing ventilators, but this is a new technology that will improve emergency response healthcare, but they're also teaming up with the state and with some epidemiologists, biostatisticians, to take a look at how these ventilators will improve treatment and healthcare. So it's a very cutting edge program that they are undertaking. So I am proud to return this to the consent agenda.
Great, thank you, Vice Mayor. Okay, items 4C through 4G. Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, item 4E, the ballistic helmets and ballistic shields. I don't know if there's The staff report said there was no testing that they could utilize for the helmets and shields I contacted. We have a local vendor in the valley that makes ballistic helmets for the military. So I contacted them the other day to see if we could get some data, because here we're referencing the need to replace stuff every 3 years and actually say just because without any data. So it'd be nice to have some data behind that, and we have we should be able to have access to that. So before we go on a 3-year replacement cycle for something that probably isn't used as much as a vest, it'd be nice to have data. So hopefully it'll be here by Monday, and if not, maybe we can...
Okay, so you want to revisit that on Monday?
Yes, please.
Okay.
And the police are all sleeping in, and I understand, so...
It's okay, he's sleeping back there.
You can be calm. Don't go ballistic over that issue. All right, so by Monday, in the review, we'll have some data for it. Okay? Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. On item 4D, I just wanted to offer a positive comment. I know those of us who've been on Public Safety Committee for the last couple of years are aware that these video systems have been available and used in other communities with very positive results. And I know we've had a small pilot program recently, but I just want to give my thanks to the police department for moving ahead on this broader pilot program, because I think this will provide benefits for the community on multiple levels. Thanks.
Thank you, Councilmember. Yeah, and we just saw that example up in Minnesota, Burnsville. I know the mayor up there quite well. I don't know if you saw that, where the guy came into the police department in the lobby yielding a knife, and the officer who was on thing had one of these units on and videotaped the whole thing. It was really interesting. Okay, anything else on that page? Item 4H through 5B, Councilmember Higgins.
Mayor, item 5B, I just wondered in the report, I wondered how many radios and batteries and backups we get for $1 million. It doesn't say anywhere in there. It just was curiosity. It was a lot of money, and it doesn't actually say how many of anything we're getting. Oh, and the fire department walked out. Oh, gosh. Okay. They were all there in the back on the right.
We'll get to the end.
Okay.
Okay.
Just really quick, you know, and of course, we're spending just a minor portion of this because it is federal grant money, which is awesome. But it still would be, and I know it's from multi-jurisdictions.
Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, I was out in the overflow. but I think I heard your question. You were asking how many radios this is going to replace.
Yeah, right.
This is going to replace all of our mobile radios, the fixed radios in our vehicles, and all of the handheld radios that we have for the fire department. So it's going to replace all of those with this grant.
For us and Apache Junction?
Apache Junction is only getting 7 out of this. And then that's the part that's the money they had for their, in fact, that's what their needs were.
So are they hundreds or thousands or tens,
Per radio?
Billions. No. Like how many systems are we getting? Because I know it's a system, you know, radio backup, batteries, ish.
Ish. Well, we have.
Dan, we will get the number.
Okay.
Yes. Well, I don't know.
Okay. Thanks.
A lot.
A lot. I hope so.
A lot.
More than one.
Okay, Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Items 5C through 8B. Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you, Mayor. Item 6B.
6B.
6 as in boy. Did we talk about this? I must have missed a council meeting, perhaps.
We didn't talk about it a whole lot. I think it was presented. Linda Crocker explained the history behind this.
I'm of the opinion that in a city our size that it'd be okay to go with 5% of the last population or the last election, and that 1,000 signatures is almost as much as Vice Mayor Summers and I had to have in each district. So I'm not in favor of lowering the signature requirement. Thanks.
And take it off consent.
Great.
And we don't have to do this. I mean, like I said, we've been gone back and forth. It doesn't really affect me one way or another. The real effect of this will come in the next election, where the number goes from, I think, 2,400? up to over probably 8,000 to 9,000.
And previously, before we went to the fall elections, the number was 1,600. So
yeah.
We're seeing an increase.
So the thought behind that was that for the next election, which won't affect me at all, it will be based on a presidential election cycle and 5% of that. What was our last vote in that?
In the last presidential?
That's where it was like 170,000 votes cast?
Right, exactly. Mayor.
So that was the reason, because it goes to like 8,000 plus. And the mayor's election, I think 2,400 is the most that's ever been required.
Correct.
Because that's based on the last one. So that's the thought process behind it. But we'll talk about that. And like I said, this isn't that pressing of an issue. And that's why the state put this, state legislature put this in, because when they required large cities to go to the November cycle, one of the unintended consequences was that it would push petition requirements for citywide offices well beyond what they had ever been before. And it's not that they increased them. They increased them, like in our case, over almost fourfold, no, three and a halffold. And so that was and the idea was, if you're going to go 8,000, means you're going to have to hire petition gatherers. That's hard to get 8,000 signatures. So that was the reason why.
I guess we experienced in the last election, Councilman or Vice Mayor Summers and I, and Councilmember Glover.
He needed like 40.
Yeah, no, that there wasn't that many more votes for council as in the last election that wasn't on that cycle. So that's...
This is a presidential election. Oh. You haven't had that yet.
Right. Mm-hmm.
No,
right.
We can look back and see how many votes were cast in 2008 presidential election as opposed to the last mayoral election. Last mayoral election, if there's 2,400, that means there was about 50,000 votes.
We had 79%, almost 80% turnout at that election.
Yeah. So you had 50,000 votes cast in the 2008 May mayoral election. You're going to have 170,000 votes cast in this one, 5% of those two. That's the reason for this.
Okay.
You go from 2,400 up to 8,500, almost 9,000 required. That to me is a burden that keeps people from running.
Yeah.
I don't think 2,400 is a burden, which is why I don't really,
right.
This won't affect me really anyway or anyone in this election. But I think when you get up to that amount, when you're looking at almost 10,000 signatures, which is more than you need to put a referendum on right now, that's a burden that keeps people running. And I don't like putting burdens on people running for office. I would prefer it to be easier for people to run for office. And Ms. Crocker.
The city of Phoenix's city charter actually has a cap for the mayor at 1,500 signatures and for council members at 200.
So the city of Phoenix, 1,500 signatures to run for mayor, and we would be 8,500 to run for mayor.
Yeah.
Okay. We can talk about it on Monday.
Okay, great, thank you.
But that's why the legislature put this ability to, and it's only for citywide offices, to opt out of this. Yeah, Vice Mayor.
Out of curiosity, what does state law allow us to do with setting caps? Is the 15,000, is that an arbitrary number, or is that set in state law somewhere? Where can we send it anywhere?
City of Phoenix went ahead and had an election and put that in there as a charter amendment. It was approved. Right now, this is the state law, so we have the ability to adopt that at this point.
At 1,000?
Well, Ms. Bronski, as I understand it, Kermit Brown, we either put it in our charter or we follow state law.
Mayor,
that's
correct.
So City of Phoenix adopted a charter provision.
Right.
I don't think by ordinance we can set that number, unless our charter allowed us to by ordinance.
That's correct.
Where do we get the 1,000? Is that in the
state
law?
That's state legislation.
Okay. Do they set anything for council districts?
No.
Just for the citywide offices?
Citywide.
All right. Can we get a number of what that's going to do for, what we estimate it's going to do for signatures in the districts as well?
Certainly, we'll
calculate. I'd like to see it.
That it doesn't affect the district.
It won't affect it.
It's
only citywide offices.
It's only at large.
All right, so we don't have to worry about that.
If our council were running, this isn't a mayoral thing. If the councils were running citywide, it would impact that. It's only citywide elections, as I understand it, right?
That's correct, Mayor.
Okay. All right, so we'll pull that off. We'll talk about it more. We'll talk about it before. Anything else on that page? Okay, now We will go to hear presentation, discuss, provide direction on the proposals received from Escobedo Development, Downtown Properties, and A New Leaf. And if I could maybe give just to sort of set the stage on this, because there, I know there are some people have questioned me as to why we're going through this process. As I best understand it, and Natalie and Mr. and John, you can correct me if I'm wrong. We've had a lot of, we had unsolicited proposals come into the city related to a variety of ideas on city-owned land in the downtown area. And we had multiple parties and individuals approach us about doing something with Escobedo, which has been closed now, how long, 4 years? 5 years almost? Okay. Has been closed that long, and obviously with the improvement in the economy, with the light rail now imminent, there's renewed interest in development. There's certainly interest in what we do with Escobedo and that area, that entire area. Not only that, but of course the Washington Center and everything. So we had these unsolicited proposals coming in, and we really don't have a mechanism, or we do have a mechanism, to process proposals, but we don't just bring unsolicited proposals and let them float around on a desk. At some point in time, there has to be a formality to that. And when we had multiple proposals come in, relating especially to Escobedo, we decided to put those into our process that we normally follow, and that's where we put out an RFP, and that puts in place a formality that allows the city to judge the merits of the proposals that are coming in within the confines of a well-defined procedure. Now, in this case, as it relates to this property, the city was not the one that initiated this. We put out the RFP simply as a means to handle the unsolicited proposal that came in. Now, what that means is that as these proposals come in, we can choose to move ahead if one of these proposals, or however we want to do, strikes our fancy and meets what our vision is for this area. We can choose to do nothing and reject all of them and say, we're not ready. We can go back and say, well, this is good, and would you do that or that or that? So I think there's sort of a little misunderstanding, at least that I've heard, that simply because we went through an RFP process, somehow the city is fixed into doing something. And just to give a little background as to why we engage it, and what a great problem to have, that you have multiple parties coming in and wanting to do something and invest money in your community. I mean, I'll take that problem any day, but it's still a problem. And then we have to deal with that, and we have to analyze that, and we have to look at it as a council, see what we do. So I don't want anyone to think that just because we have these on the table that we are fixed in having to move forward with one or the other. Is that accurate?
Yes, Mayor. The Mayor and Council, we also make one other thing very clear. Staff's not recommending any one of these projects at this point.
Yeah.
There is, and we'll talk about, there's a timeline that may affect the way these projects may want to move forward as far as financing. But as far as us being in a position to tell you that we have we don't even have a draft development agreement. We haven't put down significant concepts. Even after today, there's a tremendous amount of work that would have to be done for any one of these projects. But because of the kind of feedback we want to get today from the council is, do any one of these projects suggest to the council an interest in moving forward? Does it meet your development expectations and criteria? And we want to go through that. And if it does, are we interested in allowing it to move forward to take advantage of some distinctive financing? But I will tell you, after that, there's still a significant amount of development agreement that has to be done. And I can't sit here today and say that any one of these is in a position where we're ready to recommend, or we've even negotiated. We haven't even spent any time negotiating the terms, because every one of these proposals is expecting significant contributions or participation, maybe a better phrase, by the city. I'm not sure the council's prepared to do that or where you think it's appropriate for these types of projects. But we want to start the dialogue today. We've gone to the committee, but today just our way of kind of bring you everything that was out there, because before, if we'd brought you what we had, we didn't know who else was out there. We were approached by some groups that had been working with some of our neighborhood associates, our community development groups, and others, and so we wanted to make sure we had everything in front of us before we brought to council. So that's kind of what we're here today.
Thank you. And another thing is that, and I think there's a misperception that somehow all this stuff flew out at the last second. I think, Councilmember Glover, like in your first month in office, you got involved in hearings and some things down there. Is that not right?
Well, I know that for the past few months we've been meeting with West Mesa CDC has facilitated meetings with different groups to work with the Escobedo neighborhood and then with other developers whenever they come into the downtown area looking. They always come to my office and I always give a look over.
So this is a process that's been going on many months. Okay.
It's not just they showed up yesterday and wanted to do something.
Right. Now, the other thing about this, and Mr. Brady mentions financing, and all too often we focus on the financing, and there's no doubt that at the end of the day, financing and money is what drives projects. But this council's made it very, very clear that we are interested first and foremost in a quality project that meets our objectives and our vision for downtown and for the community. And that's what I hope drives the proposals and everything. We are bringing it forward at this time because there is a financing mechanism that's available. It involves tax credit financing. And I would hope, coming from this industry, tax credit financing is not new, especially when you relate to multifamily and multi-unit. Probably the nicest project that's around the corner from you that you would never envision involves tax credit financing does. A lot of multifamily development in all parts of this city involve financing that includes tax credit financing. So that's just a way that developments are financed. There are some deadlines that these parties have to do if they want to qualify. And the reality is that in these certain types of projects, the financial success many times is dependent on the type of financing you get. And there's no doubt that if you can get some kind of tax credit financing, it makes these projects more feasible, more viable.
Right. And Mayor, let me just make one other point to the council. You are one of the reasons we're bringing this timing is because there's a deadline for those applications to get in. I would also suggest to council why we may, if council is interested in providing some kind of letter support for a project, that's not the end. That's the beginning of a process. I mean, I could suggest to you that even after that, we would still have a tremendous amount of detail and work to go to find out whether we met, again, get comfortable with the city's participation in any one of those proposals. I don't think any endorsement of the project as they need to apply for the grant can be a suggestion that we've, and I would say this to all the applicants, they can't believe that the city is right now agreeing to what they're proposing as our participation. We have not had a chance to vet that through. We haven't determined what's the appropriate level of that, what that participation, the form of that participation. So there'd be a lot of work that would have to be done even after, if we were to be able to move forward with some kind of recommendation.
But the reason we're talking about this now is that for them to apply to submit this application, they would need some sort of letter from the city.
I think March 1st.
Councilmember Higgins.
And what you just said is, so there's nothing, the city's not on the hook for anything if we say, oh, that's a good idea.
We're not binding council other than, I think what they have to get is a letter of support expressing our interest in participation. I would be more than willing to put in that letter the caveat that's conditioned upon us reaching a mutual agreement of a development agreement or the terms of that person, because I can tell you there's a lot of the ideas that have been put forward that I'm not sure I'm at this point or I would be even comfortable recommending to the council yet. So there's a lot more work that has to be done.
They can't submit that application though unless they have some representation from the city that city
we're willing to move forward with that.
Willing to move forward with them and give them, if we reach an agreement with them, that the city would be a party of that. But it does not bind us to any kind of agreement. Go for it. Councilman Richens.
These deals are pretty complex. What are we doing to protect ourselves on our side to understand how all these moving parts work together? And do we have any expertise to help us understand how all these deals
Well, work? I think if we got that to that next step, that's something we'd have to look at. I'm not as uncomfortable about, how the tax credit works and that complexity. I think for us, it's really related to the transactional part of the development agreement. And certainly if we need the expertise, and as we tried to reach out for that, but There's not a lot of people in that area, but we certainly, if we needed it, we could certainly go out and get that. If we decide to move on to the next step.
I would assume we would get
yeah,
that.
If we need to go to the next, if the council says just go to the next step, we would certainly be willing to do that.
And when Mr. Bray's talking about the transactional part, this is city land.
Right.
So.
Or maybe a city contribution.
Or, yeah. But most of the, I think, are there any proposals that don't, that aren't on city land?
Yes.
Okay.
We do, that's right. We have that one. The La Mesita, right?
Right.
Okay. So we either have a contribution or we have it on city land, so there is heavy city involvement on all these proposals.
Yes.
Okay.
And one other clarification just for the city council to understand is one thing we have done, because this is a complex process going into it, is we have retained Dr. Sheila Harris for a short-term contract. Dr. Harris was the founding director of the Arizona Department of Housing and the Arizona Housing Finance Authority. So she was part of this, beginning this tax credit process, and is intimately familiar with it. Now, at the end of the day, this is a competitive process. And so none of us can speak for the Department of Housing on what they'll accept or not accept. But what we have tried to do and what you have been talking about is to bring a balanced approach to retain the city's rights to continue to negotiate further, but to give these teams what they need to kind of move forward and to try to be successful. But Dr. Harris is with us today if there are specific questions. But to move into the presentation just a little bit, one of the things that we will try to do is be efficient with our time, because we know you've got a full schedule before you, and there has been some process prior to this. The mayor mentioned that we went to the Community and Cultural Development Committee earlier this month. They got very detailed presentations from each of the presentation teams. Those teams are here with us as well in case there are specific questions that John and I can't handle. You've been given all of that information. And so what we wanted to try to do today was focus on this very first step and this March 1st deadline, and really just to find out, is there enough interest from the council right now where we stand with the information that we have to provide this preliminary letter of support to allow them to move forward. And we also wanted, and John is here with me, John Wesley, our planning director, to really talk about the planning, the plans that we have in place. You know, whether it's the West Mesa transit-oriented development types of plans and philosophies, form-based codes, the city zoning ordinance, the central main plan, all of these play a part in how staff reviews proposals and the fit for Mesa. And so we wanted to review each of those proposals very briefly and talk about how they align or respond to those plans. And then at the end, kind of go one by one to find out where council stands on the proposals before us.
So with that, we're going to talk first about the property out on West Main Street, the La Mesita project, which is an existing development, former hotel that they use. You can see the outline of where that property is. What they are proposing is funding this year for construction in 2013. It's a $14.5 million investment. The plan would be for a LEED certified 16-bed emergency shelter and 144 supportive housing units. They've been working on this and have had community involvement since 2010. Site plan that you see on this screen is one that they've actually submitted. We have a little bit more detail on this. Moving forward kind of at risk, but with the deadlines involved in order to, if they do go forward, they have to have their building plan submitted by May 1. They've gone ahead and started through the planning process to get the zoning they need and the site plan approval in anticipation of this being approved. And again, it's at risk. They understand that on their part. So we do, again, have a little bit more detail about what they're proposing. The building's brought up close to Main Street, as you can see on the south side, forming a little courtyard with some lower-level activity space and retail space, then units above this, and then more units in the back. And this is an early concept of what that might look like.
So once again, the idea is to push things toward Main Street.
Correct.
And not create a big setback.
That's correct.
Okay.
And so when we look at the West Main Street plan, now we see that considers this part of our TOD, transit-oriented development corridor. In this area, we are looking for buildings to be brought close to the street, generally 2 to 5 stories in height. We're thinking this will be primarily residential when we're in these mid-block areas and looking at a minimum 17 dwelling units per acre. The existing zoning in this property is a mix of commercial and multi-residence. In this location, we're not anticipating using the form-based code, but some of the other tools in our zoning code, either the MX district, the mixed-use district, attaching a new designator to the underlying zoning districts, or applying the BIZ bonus intensity zone overlay. In this particular case, they're opting to use the BIZ overlay with the zoning, which, again, allows them to modify some of those zoning standards and meet the design standards that we have anticipated for this area.
So I'm glad we're using the MXU designator biz overlay, because yeah, that makes perfect sense. I can't think of any other option I would go for.
So when we look at the plans that they have submitted and compare them to the plan for the area and the zoning designation, we see that they are striving to follow that and are in compliance with the policies and direction for this particular area. Next, we'll go to the Escobedo area. This is north of University, west of Mesa Drive. This outlines the entire property involved there on the north side of University.
Hey, John, let me ask you one thing. Now, okay, we went from one project to the other. These aren't competing projects because they're on completely separate pieces of land. And what we're going after isn't choose one over the other as it relates to, for example, these two.
From our standpoint, I think that would be correct. From the tax credit standpoint, I think they are competing against each other.
But that's up to them to go and make their case.
We're not making that.
Right. Okay. So we could issue support letters to multiple parties on different parts. Have we figured out if we have competing on the same property? And you may be going to get into this, but...
Mayor, if I'm correct, where we have two proposals for the same property, they're at different
timelines,
requesting for different time periods.
Oh, yeah. One of them is requesting us to wait and not.
One's this year and one would be the following year. So they're really, I guess.
So, okay. So we went over the La Mesita proposal, and that one is sort of a standalone.
Correct.
A New Leaf is the owner. They're the proponent. That's not really the proponent, applicant, whatever it is.
Applicant. Mm-hmm.
And so we could deal with that. And then on the Escobedo site, we could choose either, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, but I just want to set the stage so we're not confusing. There are two that are competing on that. One wants to move ahead now. One wants to have more time and wait till the next cycle.
That is
and
correct.
These credit things come around once a year?
Correct.
Okay. And March is, well.
March 1st is the first deadline.
Is the first deadline. Now, can the state housing set their own deadline, or is that set in
it's also set by
federal,
the state.
Set by statute? Okay. So what we would be looking at would be waiting for the next round of March 2013.
Correct.
Okay.
Mayor.
Yeah. Vice Mayor.
Just out of curiosity, well, I haven't slept either, so this may not come out as articulate as I would hope, but
I love it when you start lowering
expectations. I have to lower expectations.
Before you start talking. That's good news.
The public's already low expectations of my performance would probably be taken down a couple more notches, at least for today. On the La Mesita property, there are some issues related to this. We're switching from an individual housing credit to what would be a project-based housing credit, which is a change in policy how we've done. Typically, we hand individuals what turned out to be Section 8 vouchers. I'm cutting a lot of steps out, so forgive me. And now we're looking to attach that to the building. I mean, how much do we want to get into does the council want to hear a discussion on that at this point, or do we want to get that individually?
I don't know what's the practical effect of that.
It will be a policy issue for the council because today we issue them by... Where's Tammy?
By individuals.
By individuals. Otherwise, we can commit it by the project. So it stays with the project. So it becomes another financing benefit.
Yeah, but when you do Section 8.
Well, but it's portable with the individual.
But where do they go?
I mean, there's some risks.
They could go to another project.
Exactly, but that project has to be...
Seeking the project credit up front so that there is...
Well, the only difference
they stay between, with the project.
And as I understand it, the difference between this is that we go on a project base. If you have Section 8 voucher, you still go to Section 8 housing.
Right.
Which is part of a project which qualifies for Section 8 housing. Yeah. Now, most of those Section 8 either are the entire project, but most of them are mixed, right?
Right. So instead of having 1,500 vouchers that you can take to any qualifying property,
30 of those 1,500 vouchers would be assigned to this property.
To this property. So correct. So we have a total, so that's the policy change. We have a total number correct. Of.
We've just right. never, well, we've never done it.
Right.
It is a policy. It's new.
I just want to understand what that is, because I don't want people to think they can take that voucher and go to any property, because those properties still have to be qualified yeah. Section 8.
And this practice happens all over the country. It's not unusual to do this.
Right.
No, but it is a policy change, and there are issues right. related to it, which...
Well,
we have to consider.
Yeah, we have to be
clear, too, the decision's not being made today.
No, no, we got it.
Okay.
We're just trying to put the context.
But, and there is a process, and it's set by HUD, and we have to go through that, and we have to meet that. And so any letter that we give them would recognize that issue.
I think it's good the Vice Mayor brings it up, though, because before we move ahead, I would hate to give someone expectation that, oh, yeah, we're fine as long as we're going to have a development agreement, and then down the road say, oops, you know, this policy, we don't like that. And we're going to pull it back. That wouldn't be fair for anyone. So I'm glad the Vice Mayor brought it up. I know we don't have to decide it, but at least I like the fact that it's on the table. We know that there will be a policy change. It may not be significant, but it will be a policy change.
We don't have to discuss it today. I just
right.
wanted to bring
okay.
it up
no, thank you for
before
up.
We decide on anything.
Tammy, go back to your seat now.
Scheduled to vet that out at the Community Cultural Development Committee as that process moves forward
tonight?
As well. No, I don't think tonight. It's not on the agenda for tonight.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think
CDBG.
Put in context, yeah. People understand, people take the Section 8 voucher and they go to Section 8 qualified property.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about it is that most of the time you don't know where that property is, because most time that really nice apartment complex down the street probably is a mixed thing, and there's Section 8 housing in that complex, because that's how apartment complexes are financed.
Yeah, our housing team has been, and the people that work with federal funds have been working on a whole suite of changes to help make that program work a little bit more efficiently and reflect the needs in Mesa a little bit better.
Just to finish up, like, you may have a 200 unit apartment complex, and I don't know what the percent, 20 units are Section 8, and the other 180 are market rate. Is that right, Mr. Richards? Or I don't know what the percentages are, but there will be a percentage of those that are. Could be qualified, but generally they're only required to do a certain amount, and then they mix between the subsidized and the market rate. So I don't want people to think that just because there's a tax credit that it goes to a specific property that is some different. There's around your corner, like I said, there could be and probably is a multifamily unit that is a mixed unit thing between subsidized and market rate. Okay. All right, go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry, you. I mean, sorry to spend this time. I just want to lay the foundation so everyone knows how we're looking at this.
So, again, on the Escobedo property, there are two proposals that we've received. First one we'll talk about is the Gorman team proposal. This is the one that's planning to submit this year for the tax credits and then develop in two phases. Ultimately, they are planning a LEED certified project with 124 rental units with 1, 2, 3, and 4 bedroom units. They're proposing to retain 4 of the existing structures in the Escobedo area to rehabilitate, to retain that historic character. And then also they have been deeply involved with the neighborhood over the last few months, seeking their input on this particular project. And here is a graphic example of the concept that they're proposing. Again, university here on the south. This shows the first phase development with these what appear to be primarily townhome-type units in this area and more apartment-type over here on this portion of the property. And then phase two would fill in the back piece. And this does also include some activities here on the south side of University for community service-type activities. The other proposal is the Urbanist Team proposal. And, again, they're looking at actually submitting for the tax credit program the following year in 2013. And they are looking at, again, LEED certified project, a little bit more units here on this project, 169 rental units and 56 single family units that have both the rental and lease sale options in their particular proposal, proposing community garden. They have started some of the neighborhood outreach efforts with their project also. And this is an illustration of what they're anticipating right now in terms of concept of their development, with the lower intensity units on the west side and stepping up to higher intensity units as it moves to the east. And also proposing possibility of some retail space within the development. As we've looked at this compared to some of our plans for the area, in the Central Main plan, we talk about maintaining the residential use as a primary use on this property. We want to support maintenance of the existing neighborhood to the north and the west of this area as this develops. So we looked at the idea of lower intensity uses on the west side that can blend with that neighborhood, but then stepping up that density intensity as we move east and south across the property. We recommend a mix of housing types for the area that can provide for a mix of incomes. And then we also think it's appropriate to provide for non-residential uses, particularly along the university frontage, as that may be appropriate. This property is currently zoned a mix of downtown residential 3 and RM4, so it's got multifamily residential zonings on it. We did look at it, though, in terms of if we were to apply the form-based code, what transect zones we think would be most appropriate for this area. We haven't actually mapped it yet, but consider it could be easily extended across this portion of university.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins has a question.
Thank you, Mayor. Do you think that until we know what the new code things are, we could, like, reference the old code or something so we have a clue? Because that's really tricky without pulling out the big binder. And what's T3 now? Because it's...
It missed the T-zone, like, right here.
What you know what I'm saying?
What was wrong with the MXU-UV-light zone? Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I like that.
You know, it's all new to everybody, so...
Just do the narrative description, not the...
Did this serve anybody that we help write it?
So, yeah. Again, the existing zonings on the property are the standard zone. It was the town center residential 3 is now downtown residential 3. It's
hey, Tom, how about you say, based on what we want to accomplish there, whether we can do it with the zoning in place or whether we need to do it with some new zoning and whether we can accomplish... that. I mean, that's what I'm interested in,
right.
Because I have no idea what the existing zoning is. I could find out by going looking in the book, like Councilman Higgins said. I want to know if what's been proposed, first of all, meets our vision.
Right.
And if it meets our vision, what do we have to do zoning-wise to make that happen?
Right. Okay. The short answer is that with both proposals, the existing zoning works. They don't have to change any zoning. In terms of their actual development of these two proposals that we've seen, the only thing that may be needed before they would go to building permits is they've talked about potentially lowering the parking requirements. They may have to go through a board of adjustment process to adjust the parking.
Well, what we'll do, though, is that, I mean, this is really not going to be driven by the zoning. It's going to be driven by our development agreement because we're going to decide on between the developer and the city what standards we're going to meet. And I would expect, rather than have this be a backward approach, said, oh, here's the zoning, here's what you can do. I'm not personally interested in following that. I'm saying, here's what we want to build.
Right.
Now, what do we have to do to make that?
We would include that as part of the
development. Yeah, if that means changing zoning, we'll change zoning. If that means, because I don't want the zoning to be a hindrance, the technical side to be a hindrance. I think that's the problem we've run into before. We're partners in, regardless of which project, we're partners in this. So we have a say, a major say in what happens. And I would hate to see an ordinance limit our ability to upgrade quality.
Correct.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so that's where we went ahead and looked at it in terms of the form-based code, because that does give us a little bit more direction than standard zoning in terms of laying out the building forms in a pattern that we think would be what we want to see in the area. And so with this particular diagram that we put together, just gives one concept that we think would work well in the area. And again, trying to give enough information but not take too long. The form-based code uses what are called T-zones, and the T3 neighborhood zone is a residential zone. It's kind of the lowest end of the zones that we get in that area. And we're proposing that this area along the west side would receive or should be built consistent with that T3 neighborhood, which allows for single residential units, which is kind of the primary unit you'd see in that area, but also allows for duplexes, small what are called mansion apartments and townhomes to be built in that area. And so we've shown one concept in terms of how then this could actually be built with a variety of those single-family, duplex, and mansion apartment areas if that were done. One of the key factors with the form-based code is it really is trying to orient the uses towards the street and activate that street. So this does show the buildings brought out to the street and oriented to the street where we would get that type of activity. The next district that we think would be appropriate for this area is a T4 neighborhood, which is the next step up in intensity of residential districts. It is a neighborhood district, which, again, only allows for residential uses. but it moves on up in terms of the intensity and starts to allow actual apartment units to be built in addition to the townhomes, the mansion apartments, and again, single family could be in this area. And then along the university street frontage itself, we would suggest a T4 neighborhood flex, and that the difference in the neighborhood flex is that it allows for ground floor retail uses or non-residence uses should you want them to be developed. And it starts to allow then the Main Street mixed-use building type to go in there. Again, it could all be built as residential, be occupied as residential, but would allow the opportunity for ground floors to be non-residential if the market should drive it that way. But again, in all these zones, again, the idea is to bring things to the street, activate the street, and create the neighborhood and the flow of traffic in the neighborhood, which we think is important. And so when we look at the two proposals compared to the sub-area plan, what we're looking for and what we think would be appropriate zoning-wise, they both have their pluses in how they do that. The Gorman team proposal appears to align pretty well with the goals for the area. The buildings are mostly oriented to the street. They have that transition in density across the site. It could be a little bit more intense than what they're proposed. We'd like to see a little bit more density there than what they have. They could have a little bit more variety in the building types. They've just got a couple in there right now. Again, understand we're looking at a concept plan and a sketch, and I'm not discussing with them in detail what all they're doing, but that's the way it appears from what was seen. And some of that transition could be a little bit better from the existing neighborhood to this area. In terms of the urbanist team, they have a little bit more transition in that density across the site, starting with a single story and going up to four-story across the property. Their project is not as well oriented to the streets. It kind of creates their own little cul-de-sacs and pockets of development in the actual streets, Pasadena and Hibbert. Don't really have much that fronts on them directly. They have kind of that two types of housing, so it's a kind of a limited variety of housing. And again, that transition from the existing single-family neighborhood is fairly abrupt. And so, again, could be a little bit better in terms of what we would anticipate from the planning side. So those are those two project proposals for the Escobedo site. The next one we have is the downtown site, which is the Municipal Plaza parking area just to the east of the plaza building in this location, taking down both of those parking areas is what is being proposed right there along Main Street. Again, they are proposing to submit this year and be operational by the end of 2013. They're proposing a five-story, 85-unit residential project for seniors. And would have some active space along the Main Street frontage and are configuring it so that they would help support that pathway along the west side of the project that extends from the Art Center up to the library. This shows the concept that they are working with. Again, the plaza building itself is over here, and here's the pathway. And so the building is along that and along the south side with parking in the northeast portion. Central Main plan for this particular area puts this in the modern downtown area where we envision mid to high-rise buildings to occur. It speaks mostly about employment uses happening this close to the light rail station within this block. It also looks at this whole city campus block that we have and the need to look at it and develop it as a whole unit to meet both the city employment needs, other employment needs, and then provide opportunities for housing as may be appropriate. Strengthen that pathway, and also discourage the surface parking. We'd like to see a trend towards more of the structured parking area so we can make maximum use of the property. In terms of the form-based code, and this area has been mapped, and it is proposed to be zoned to the T6 Main Street zone. This zone has a four-story minimum height. It requires buildings to be brought to the property lines. Looks for active uses on the ground floor, talking about retail, restaurants, business support services, those type of things have regular traffic coming and going, and entrances every 50 feet along the street, again, trying to get that traffic along the main street, and would also look to 100% lot coverage and structured parking. So the two proposals, Thornton Homes didn't provide any information to review, but they are looking for future interest in the area. So the two proposals, the Mesa Housing Association, they have a good urban forum. They've been in, they've visited with us, we've looked at what they're proposing. It's as I recall, five-story building brought to the street. Looks like some good architecture. Would meet a lot of the objectives from the basic building form and massing that we'd like to see in this area. They're proposing the ground floor along Main Street to be activity space for residents of the complex, but not necessarily really active uses that would help engage the street. They're using the surface parking. And it may not be consistent with the total way we want to develop the overall city campus. We don't really have that plan specifically outlined yet. So I'm going to bring it back to Natalie in terms of kind of where we're at in the process and the direction that we're looking for at this time.
Councilman Richens.
Good. You were light on some of the details of Thornton's proposal, and they were light on their details as well. But when they presented it to the Cultural Committee, they talked about developing on individual sites, so maybe smaller parcels that the city might own, developing some single-family home infill within the downtown with some of the stuff that they talked about doing. And we thought that was a very interesting proposal because we do have some smaller parcels like Temple Court that potentially could be great potential single-family infill on city-owned lots. So I just wanted to throw that out there. So
how does that work? And that's eligible for the kind of credit?
No. Okay. No, they were not attached to tax credit. That was just a market rate deal in partnership with the city to develop some of our potential single-family home lots that we own downtown.
And is that separate from the proposal that they have here? Is that part of the proposal they have?
No, the proposal that they made was to do that, to identify some smaller lots that could be potential single-family infill.
And what they told us, too, is they're just very interested in doing something in the downtown area, some kind of infill project, like Councilmember Richens mentioned, and that they would be very interested in responding to any future requests for proposals from the city. And so they are separate from kind of this deadline that we've been talking about.
Yeah, so we can pursue a completely separate program with them if we wanted to, because it's a unique program and it doesn't involve this deadline.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Okay, gotcha.
Exactly. So if you could go to the next slide. Generally, what we're looking for is very kind of preliminary direction from the City Council. And what I thought, if it's okay with you, is we could go one by one through each of these developments just to make sure that we're getting specific direction from you. What staff plans to do is, if one or more of these that you want to provide some preliminary support, we would draft some letters of support. We'll work between now and Monday with the development team to kind of achieve that balance of retaining our rights to negotiate further, but also to give it as much clarity as we can to help them with their application process. And then we would bring those to the City Council for your formal approval on Monday. So that is kind of the next step in the process. So with La Mesita, they're asking for some preliminary support of their concept. They're asking us to at least acknowledge this voucher need that the Vice Mayor brought up, and that we would be willing to work with them within the context. And we would want to make sure the language is specific to say that within the context of the process that is laid out and prescribed by the federal government through HUD. And they are looking for some future city participation. And so, again, without putting any details in this letter, we would acknowledge our willingness to continue those conversations.
So we're saying we'd go as far as we need to enable them to make the application without binding the city to any obligations other than enabling them to go forward.
Exactly.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. With respect to the La Mesita proposal, I would hope that we would give positive direction to this proposal. I know that from my council district's perspective and residents, it's viewed favorably. This is, I think, a positive and creative response to a challenge that Councilmember Richens laid down 2 years ago in terms of better use of this site. And I appreciate and applaud what Amir Leaf has done in response to his challenge. I think it certainly does meet what our expectations were for transit-oriented development along the light rail. And it's a very good complement to that. And so I appreciate Mr. Richens issuing that challenge. I think this is a very good start. So I would hope we would give some positive direction for preliminary support. I do think that the issue of vouchers is an interesting question that we should discuss because, again, as Councilmember Richens points out, what New Leaf is proposing is not unique. It's done around the country terms of to make projects pencil out. So I look forward to the discussion on that. But I would certainly hope that we would, the council would support moving ahead in a favorable way on this one. Thanks.
Thank you, Councilmember. Any questions on the La Mesita? Yeah, Councilmember Higgins?
Just what you had, Councilmember Kavanaugh just said. Last year, how we looked at Section 8 housing, you know, how we looked at more of the, we moved up the chronically ill to the top of the list. Remember that? Like super sick. We changed how we looked at our Section 8, right, to make sure that we weren't letting residents, you know, with cancer die under a dumpster, right? So we went out looking for them, and we made some changes. So how would this affect, you know, La Mesita right now is after families, right, helping family shelter. So how might that affect who actually can be in La Mesita if we already looked at changing the way we looked at Section 8 housing?
Oh, she was hiding back there. I'm sorry. Everybody's turning their head looking for Tammy.
And Tammy, if I'm wrong, I think it's going to meet the needs of their current clientele. So, I mean, I don't think it changes anything other than helping the project pencil as part of the.
I see Mr. Project. Hughes back there nodding. He's either going to sleep or he's. Okay.
We would have to process a substantial amendment that does have to be approved by HUD. We have a consultant coming in to help us look at how to set this up to best meet our needs, because there's lots of different options. One of the biggest things we want to do is make sure that we don't circumvent our waiting list. So the clientele that they are serving there are currently our preference on our waiting list. Okay. So that would help us keep that from happening. But we're looking at all of this, and we'll be coming to you with a complete plan later on.
Yeah, so what, just to summarize so I understand it, what you're saying is that we can't bump people and just go in and carve out and say, okay, we're going to put this in, and, oh, you guys are on the waiting list, forget it. But what you're saying is that the clientele they have are basically the clientele we're currently serving, and therefore it slides in and fits nicely, and you don't see a major upset of the program. Now, granted, we're early on in the stage.
Yes.
But just from the overview, you think that it would fit in nicely with what we're doing anyway.
Yes, because their client who lives there comes from our waiting
list.
They don't. It's not their choice to place anybody there. Those people have to be a part of our waiting list when we open our waiting list. And so if that's who our preference is, they would go to the top anyways.
Okay. So what we're doing is we're taking an existing building, we're upgrading it, we're bringing it up and making it a nice transit-related development, and it really shouldn't have a significant impact on our voucher program and how we administer that anyway is what I'm hearing.
Well, we are working with a consultant, and we hope
to
bring
a
program that will forward to you that would eliminate that.
Okay.
But Tammy,
it's not a drastic change.
You got to say it. I mean, it stays with the project.
Absolutely. Right now we
have. So those people could move on, but the voucher stays with the project.
If they are issued a voucher, they have to sign a year lease for that location. But then they come and they get the next available tenant-based voucher, and they can go anywhere.
Okay.
And that leaves an open spot there. So then the next person who would meet that clientele on our list, depending on, like I said, we're still crunching through these details, would have the option to be placed there if they wanted. It's always up to the tenant.
I guess what I was trying to make you to get what Councilmember Higgins was saying, though, this isn't going to create a cosmic interruption in our overall program. There are some tweaks and things that, and the consultant will work with us, but you know, I would be worried, other than the fact that we are now designating the project for vouchers, as far as the clientele served, those that are on the list, if we were to move ahead with this, and let's say La Mesita was successful, that wouldn't create an overall huge, huge shift in the waiting list or how we process. It seems to fit in there. Does that make sense at all?
It appears to at this point, yes.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear.
And I just wanted to make sure that the families that La Mesita currently is serving don't get pushed out because of our other decisions we've made in the last year about how, you know, that you do remember that discussion, the chronically ill. I wasn't by myself, right? We had that discussion, yes.
Those families would have to be on our waiting list. And so we have to look at how often we would open our waiting list, because there's a lot more administration here. So we'd have to look at when do we open our waiting list to allow all families from all anywhere to join our waiting list. And so it might not be somebody who was served in their shelter. It could be somebody else served anywhere that would be placed in their
So is facility. It going to 100%, is that 100% of the spaces available? No, I see heads nodding. No.
No.
Avail- the, on the vouchers? No, there's going to be both. So you can still serve the people you're currently serving or a percentage of.
These would be the vouchers.
Let me ask you, what's the increase in the number of units versus the current look, existing versus expansion?
Right now, they have, I think, 30 units for emergency shelter housing. And what they're proposing is 16 emergency shelter units and 144 apartment units.
Okay. So we're going up total 106, almost 160.
160.
So as far as the combination of the emergency and the other stuff, we're increasing fivefold. Okay. All right.
Vice Mayor? Tammy, what do you mean there's more administration?
Right now, we open our waiting list every so many years. Once we get to about 300 or 400 on our waiting list, then we will open it up. Has not been opened up for quite some time because we had 1,500. So right now, we have already placed all of our chronically homeless. Mm-hmm. If that is the target for those project-based vouchers, we would have to open the waiting list on a more regular basis. Now, again, we're working with a consultant. I believe at this point we can open our waiting list just for the chronically homeless. And then we would always have a waiting list of folks that could choose to live there. Keep in mind, if there's a project-based voucher and a tenant-based voucher, tenants always have the choice. Doesn't matter who they are. They could say, I want the tenant-based voucher. I don't want that project-based voucher. So we'd go to the next person. And we might only have project-based vouchers, but they still have that choice to take it or not take it.
Okay. And do we anticipate that increase in administration to be ongoing once we go to project-based, or is that going to be a short-term deal as we open them?
We would try to line it up so that it minimized maybe a couple times a year, maybe three times a year or something that, like that for short periods of time. We would work to minimize that extra.
Do we get reimbursed from that from the Fed, or is that on us, the city?
When you move some of your tenant-based vouchers to project-based vouchers, you don't gain any more. We have to convert some of the ones we have to it. And then you have to wait till they're available and say, okay, I have 5 available this month. We will move those over to project-based. So the same amount of caseload, it's just maintaining the wait list differently. That could be a difference.
Yeah, with this particular project, there are a lot of moving parts, and especially as we're talking about a shift from tenant-based to, or at least a portion of tenant-based to project-based. That said, while I have some concern on that and what the impact is going to be fiscally for the city of Mesa and how that's going to impact our vouchers, there are some elements about this that I like. It's taking, well, let's be truthful, it's taking a really crappy building, bulldozing it, and creating something new that really matches, meets what the council has talked about
for a long
time.
Is that a technical term?
It is.
I have technical terms that are not suitable for a PG audience.
And that was?
You're trying me. I'd be interested at least in pursuing this because I think it matches a lot of what we had talked about in the council and the opportunity to take what used to be an old motel, as I recall, and getting rid of that and creating something a little special. I think at least at this point, since we're not locking ourselves into anything, is worth pursuing. With a caveat, I have a lot of concern over how much this is going to cost us, both in administrative costs, but also out-of-pocket costs on the front end. So we have a lot of discussions between here and final approval. So okay. With that, I think we should move forward.
Any other questions on Loma Cedar? Do we want to give them direction to move forward with that? I'm seeing a lot of nods, and I know Dennis supported. Councilman Richards?
I just throw in one of the things that I think our council has challenged people about has been using these kind of programs to do transformative community projects to really, you know, step it up from maintaining a particular program to doing stuff that's going to change the face of our community for a lot of years. And I think a new leaf should be commended about responding to that challenge. I'm so impressed with what they've come and how far that they have really challenge their organization as a whole to be able to meet the needs of our community better. And so I just want to give big praise to them publicly about responding to the challenges that our community has, really. It wasn't anyone I issued. It was the needs of our community that you guys are reflecting, the desire to serve, and I appreciate that. And so to me, this is really the essence of what we meant when we said transformative community projects. Thank you.
So is transformative community projects synonymous with bulldozing crappy buildings?
It's a more eloquent way of saying
okay.
That, yes.
And I would.
I was waiting for Build a Better Mesa, Dave. I'm very disappointed.
I would. You know, to me, and I get it that there's some technicalities that we'll have to work out with because of the program we're in. But I commend a New Leaf because this is exactly the kind of redevelopment that we would look for. It really is taking something and making it a lot better. And it's a twofer for me. It really fits within the concept of Form Base in that it creates a presence along Main Street. What we want to accomplish, it increases not only the number but certainly the quality of development, and I think it will have a huge impact on that area. And we see that in development, like in anything else, if there's investment and there's an upgrade, there's a tendency to follow, and you get other investments. So. I think you got unanimous support to move ahead with the La Mesita.
Okay, thank you.
Is that adequate?
That's what we need, and
we'll bring it back on Monday.
Right. Yep. But let's go ahead with the idea that we would move toward issuing that letter.
Okay, and then the next one we wanted to talk about is Escobedo and the Gorman Save the Family and West Mesa CDC team proposal. They are, again, going after the 2012 schedule. And first and foremost, I mean, aside from a general concept that of support and this same language about city participation, they need a preliminary nod of site control. And again, we will write this in such a way as to really protect our rights to continue those negotiations and make sure council in the end makes those final decisions or weighs in into those key terms.
I mean, I don't know how you look at this without putting it in context with the overall, with the other proposal too.
The other proposal is not asking for a letter or next year.
If we decide to move forward with this project, it basically eliminates the...
It sets it up to eliminate.
No, I don't think it does.
Right.
Okay, well, let's talk about that because that's what I want to hear.
Right.
I think the opportunity you have here is you have a state process that is vetting projects for this special financing mechanism, and there's a potential that we could support this project, and it could still not get access to financing.
Okay, what if it does?
If it does, then there's still a significant negotiation that has to take place. So there's still possibility that this could not work out, and to have another developer that's interested in the next round is a good thing.
I just want to make sure
preserve our opportunity with both. And I actually this Escobedo the Gorman proposal is not a bad proposal, and I think it they've done significant work in the neighborhood. I have to really compliment them on that process. And to me to give them a little preliminary support to start through this process. I have some doubts about their ability to be successful in this proposal. I'm not convinced that they're going to get some of the points they're going after because it's all about scoring points on these for the special financing. And if they can't get some of the points they're going after, they're not going to be successful with an award. So for me to say, hey, let's support them, get them started down the process, and let's see if they can be successful. If they are successful and they can get a project in the ground, we still win. If they can't, we have another great developer right behind them.
I don't disagree. I would hope that we don't lead someone down the line, have them, maybe they do score the points, and then all of a sudden we say, well, you know, we're having second thoughts now. And that's okay as long as they know going in that that's a possibility. Because I think it is. Councilor Glover.
You know, it is a great privilege and honor to represent the Washington Park and Escobedo neighborhoods, particularly since most of my district, their resident turnout for events is pretty low, but at Washington Park, Escobedo, it is a great turnout, and I'm And one thing that I have to commend Gorman, just like Councilmember Richens, they put in the legwork for this area. They went out and with the help of Save the Family, West Mesa CDC, they organized these meetings. And what I particularly like about the project is that they worked to incorporate everything that those residents wanted. They basically gave them the pen and the pad of paper and said, what do you want to see in your neighborhood? And they came up with the design. They do not want anything too high, like too many stories, because they don't want it to overlooking into their neighborhood. That's one of the things, verticality. And I know some members of the council might disagree with me, but I don't consider Washington Park and Escobedo part of the downtown area. That does not fit that criteria. I think that we really do need to look at the needs of the neighborhood. And Gorman has done projects like this in the past, and I've seen actually been to one of the projects, and I'm very impressed with their work and with the new leadership of Save the Family under Jackie Taylor. I'm really impressed with their vision of what they want to do and working with the neighborhood, incorporating everything they want to, and that I think this will be a game changer for the neighborhood. And one of my great fears is whoever we go to, I want to make sure that they do listen to the neighborhood, take in their considerations, because I think it's a tad presumptuous for us to dictate to that neighborhood what we want to see there when we don't live there. I think that we should choose what is best for the neighborhood, absolutely. However, I think that when we do work with the neighborhood, it is something that when we incorporate their ideas, they're able to own that decision. And this is from what I've heard from many of the residents in that area, that they are very happy with the Gorman, West Mesa CDC, and Save the Family. So that's why I'm in support of that. But I do like your idea of we have this. If they don't have, they don't score the right number of points, then we do have a project waiting in the wings. But I am in support of Gorman.
Okay. Good. Vice Mayor.
I had several concerns with this project, both of these projects actually, when it came to the initial council, the community cultural group. My main concern is that I didn't see a vision for this area, the one that has been just recently discussed about what the neighborhood wanted. The Harvard Loeb Fellows did a charrette or two on this particular site. I have not seen it.
Vice Mayor, just to cut in, I know that Teresa Bryce was
heck
here.
No, what the?
Sorry, I'm going to do that. The
wait a second, I run this meeting. You can cut in.
I have the floor, Your Honor.
Have at it, Councilor Glover.
I appreciate it.
I'd actually
sorry,
Vice
Mayor.
I do need to go over my 1,000-word limit for the day.
Okay,
so,
good.
Teresa Bryce was here earlier. I don't know if she still is, but she had.
She's back there.
Oh, Teresa. Hi, Teresa, back there. She had mentioned it to me. They're going to be publishing that. I'm sure she'll be able to get it to everyone on the council. I know that she was going to specifically send it to me since I do represent that area, but she's going to give it to everyone on the council in the near future.
Right. And when we were discussing this in the CCD, I didn't have that. So I think if we're going to judge these particular pieces, having the report from the charrette from the Harvard Loeb Fellows would be important for helping us measure it. The other concern I have is that this piece technically doesn't get all doesn't meet all the points for this year's tax credit measures. What I mean is that they wanted the most points on a section of this comes from being within, I think it's a half a mile or a certain distance from light rail. In order to meet that, they have to be south of University, which is why both of these have a little cutout there. Site 17, as you are well aware, is extremely important to the downtown area, and I would agree that south of University is really what's in our downtown, because that's within the walking distance of the light rail. Hence, that's why the points are being given out. This particular piece was rather glossed over, and it was a fairly robust discussion about what the Escobedo portion would look like. Not a lot of discussion about what this is. If we're going to approve these projects, ultimately, we need to have a more detailed discussion about how this part of the property fits with the downtown plan, not so much Escobedo. So before I'm comfortable approving anything, I would like to get, one, I would like to see what the charrette report says as soon as possible, and if we can get a council maybe a council study session piece, a presentation on that would help very much. And secondly, a more robust discussion about what this piece south of University looks like. and how that fits into the downtown plan, which we're all very familiar with.
Yeah, go ahead, Councilman Richards.
Why does it make a difference for you to see that? I'm trying to understand, because if the neighborhood residents developed it, it's what their vision is, whether you see it or not. So I'm trying to understand what's the importance of that. Sure, Chris and I attended it. We watched the process start. So I just don't understand.
Because I'm making a decision on it, and you telling me that it meets their neighborhood goal is doesn't do it for me.
Okay.
I would like to see the charrette. I mean, they spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, on putting the charrette together. They had the Harvard Loeb come in. If I'm going to make a decision on it and looking at these two projects, I want to be able to rate them based on how that fits into our plans from planning zoning, which I think are fine. But the charrette is going to be an important, for me, a litmus test for how this is going to fit in with the neighborhood.
Well,
we do this all the time.
I know. Well, the question on the table today, though, is are we going to allow this to move forward to give it a letter of support or not?
Well, I think we have to look at two things here, too, and deal with really two realities. The first reality is, and I would agree with Councilmember Glover, although this borders downtown, this is not downtown. And the reason I say that is that this is well-defined as to what this will develop out as. This is going to be residential. Because that's the history, that's how it flows and fits in with the neighborhood, and I think that's really what this will be. It'll be hopefully a high-quality residential that'll lift the entire area, and that will be something we're all proud of. I'm not saying just because it's residential. We have to accept average. I don't want to accept average. We don't need to. But that gets to the second part, which gets into your comment, Vice Mayor, about the half acre or the half mile. The location of where it is means it's going to be real hard to ever finance any project on this site without some sort of tax credit scheme. Just because of where it is and the type of development, I just don't see that happening through traditional financing sources. I think we're going to have to be involved. And maybe that's possible. Maybe I'm missing some here. And what that means is we need to work to accommodate that, because I think that's how we make the development here a possibility. Am I missing something? Or am
no,
I
think you're absolutely right. And one of the questions that we had that I don't know if we got an answer yet to that was the environmental remediation that has to happen at Escobedo. I believe those buildings have a substantial amount of asbestos. When you're using federal funds, you have to do the phase one environmentals. You have to make sure that you turn over a site that's clean and developable. And this site, from a city perspective, is not site-ready developable.
Right.
There's some significant
costs. So that's one of the questions needs to be answered.
With. So, yeah, that's one of the questions.
The other part about this, and it ties into all these proposals, is there's an out-of-pocket cost to the city we have to discuss, because I don't think the infrastructure, the underground infrastructure, is adequate for what's needed. So the other part of these two proposals, which I won't get too in depth, is the difference between the city owning the land and the developer paying for the infrastructure, or getting cash for the land.
Getting back to what
right,
Mr.
And
that, said, that's all part of the second part and the development agreement.
Exactly, and the devil is in the details in these things, and there are important decisions that have to be made, because there are going to be potentially out of pocket costs for the city in moving forward with some of these things.
Right.
Well, I don't think potentially. I think there's a given.
No,
that the
yeah.
City, once again, we
how much is this?
Yeah, we owned it. We still own it, and there's no doubt that there are both utility upgrades, regardless of what happens here. I mean, even if we go and blade the entire site, there's utility removals. There's a lot of work the city would end up doing,
and there's
no doubt that there's environmental issues.
Yeah, we have a presentation on our capital improvement program, and we've had significant disinvestment in this community for a long time, and we need to do some infrastructure investment in the Escobedo Washington Park neighborhood, both in underground and streetlight type
said,
infrastructure.
Mayor, if I may interject one more time, I'm going to reverse my decision from the CCD. And I'm going to recommend that we move forward with both these. I'm very tentative on that, and I'm very cautious about what's going to happen on the south side. I'm extremely interested in what happens on the south side of this property and how that's going to fit into the downtown piece. Just like in the first presentation, the opportunity to bulldoze some crappy buildings and replace them with something that's actually useful has some appeal to me. At least this morning. Maybe it's a fact I haven't had any sleep.
You and John Wesley throwing out those technical terms.
I'm sorry.
Okay, we'll go back to Councilmember Glover, since you've been involved in this, and this is in your district. You're in support of moving forward with this proposal?
Yes,
sir.
Okay. Who cares what he thinks? I'm for let's just...
You know, Vice Mayor, that's what I think about every time you open your mouth.
Okay. Councilmember Kavanaugh. Could someone pick... Could someone pick Dave up from off the floor? Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Well, I will be uncontroversial for once, and I support Councilmember Glover's analysis of the Gorman project. And I'm doing so from the perspective of serving on the West Mesa CDC board, because our board has been integrally involved in this process in terms of helping to work with the neighborhood, with the Charette, with the Harvard Loeb consultants. And I certainly, at least from my perspective, this proposal has a lot of pluses, and I hope we move forward with preliminary support. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember?
I agree with Vice Mayor Summers that this is a good opportunity to get rid of some crappy buildings. And Councilmember Glover's point that it's not part of downtown, and that was an excellent point, because, you know, I kind of looked at it thinking it's more of downtown, but it really is a neighborhood. And to upgrade this neighborhood might be the catalyst to start developing south into what we really want our downtown to be. So I'm in favor of whatever the
letter.
The letter, yes, okay. Thank
and
you.
And only a letter.
Yeah.
Okay, so we will bring a letter forward.
Well, Councilmember Fenter,
okay.
I think,
sorry.
Had a...
Sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry, just a quick comment. You know, for those of us,
Dave,
I used
by
to...
By the way, you let us do the counting, okay? It's us to count the votes up here, okay? Thank you, Natalie.
Thank
you. Councilmember Fenter.
That's too good. You know, as a little boy, I used to swim in the Escobedo Pool and grew up, I know, with the mayor and others, with folks from the community there. I think the community in Mesa is going to be really excited to see something happen here and to take, an area that's had some challenges and make it positive. It's one of those big wins you put on the board, and I think that's how it's going to be viewed in the community. So really excited to support what's going on here.
Okay, now you can count.
Okay.
I think, move ahead with the letter on the same.
So the letter for the Gorman, Save the Family, West Mesa CDC, and then I guess what I'll do is work with the developer. Am I hearing generally that you are supportive of that concept as well if the Gorman, for whatever reason?
Nope.
Ahead.
Yeah, so, jump away because we haven't asked.
We go through this process, let it go through the scoring. Right. Well, and if it's successful, we have a negotiate. We bring back the council negotiation. We'll work. That's down the road.
Okay.
The point is, we come to a successful conclusion on it. Well, that determines whether or not we're doing.
Yeah,
that.
I just wouldn't shut the door on the other proposal.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm just saying what I hear the council is move to the next step.
It'll play out,
and then we'll play out the rest of the negotiations.
Okay. Now, we have a lot of blue cards wanting to talk about, and most of these are on this. Normally, in a study session, we don't. This is for us to gather information, and we're not making a final decision on the go or no go. So we don't normally, like in a regular council meeting where we take input, although I will, for on the record, say that there's Cynthia Dunham and Denise Lowell Britt and Betty Shockley and Krista Shockley. I'm assuming you're all talking on the Gorman proposal, okay? All are in support. We'll put that on the record. And if you still wish to say something in the... Okay, good. And then Maria, support? Okay. So we have... you'll have... Believe me, this is the first thing. There will be a lot of input and a lot of opportunity to speak. Yeah, Maria?
For the record, I am not in support of Gorman.
Okay, so for the record, we'll have Maria's not in support, believe me, I'm not trying to cut you off. It's just there'll be a lot of times when you'll have plenty of opportunity to, and we'll be very, very interested in your thoughts on this. This is just the very, very first preliminary step. Okay, let's go to the next one then.
Okay, so the Mesa Housing Associates proposal is basically to repurpose a parking structure for the Mesa City Plaza, which currently we call the Orange Lot and our Covered Lot, and it is about 133 spaces. And they're suggesting some senior housing, and again, moving forward with this 2012 tax credit timeline. And so, again, they need the same types of support letter and preliminary site control from the city.
This one's a little bit more interesting. Dave.
I'll jump in this one right away.
This one is a lot more interesting, particularly the site that's been chosen. This developer was looking around sites around the Arts Center, around that center and Main Light Rail Station. They've done a pretty beautiful project in Tempe that they've worked with the city of Tempe to the west of their downtown that I really appreciate. The thing that's interesting about this project, it goes on the parking lot to on most of the people around this table. But we've sat here for the last 3.5 years talking about a vision for downtown, talking about how we want to see some transformative community projects, see some exciting things happen in our downtown. And this particular developer is requesting where we park our cars. And I don't think there's any better message that we could send right now to say, you know what, I'm willing to walk another however far and park my car somewhere else to get these transformative community projects in downtown. That is leadership by example, and I think to start here sends a very interesting message to the development community that the city of Mesa is ready to do deals. We're ready to have development happen in our downtown. We're ready to embrace these form-based codes and these different ideas, and we invite people to come and be innovative. This proposal has come, and it's innovative. And it may not be the specific user that we might have in mind, but it has the form that we've been desiring to happen in downtown. And so I'm supporting this project because of that reason. I think we need to put our money where our mouth is. And if we're gonna see some transformation happen in our downtown, let it start right where it'll affect us all personally the most. And so with that, I'll turn out to my colleagues for further discussion.
Okay, Councilman Kavanaugh.
Well, I guess I'll give up my parking space too. This is an interesting project, and for a site that is right now designated for city use, but I think with the development of light rail through downtown, I think we have to be open to interesting projects like this. And so, I'm certainly not opposed to providing a preliminary support for this. I think there's obviously some more work that needs to be done, looking at the architectural style and how it complements the Art Center in various uses there, but. I've seen the project in Tempe that this applicant has produced, and it's a pretty wonderful product. And so I certainly think this is an interesting location, but not one that I would oppose. I think it's worthy of moving forward. Thank you.
Okay. Councilman Glover.
You know, I have to concur with Councilmember Richens and Councilmember Kavanaugh. I too toured the facility in Tempe, and it was really interesting. I'm not opposed to this site. I'd like to see what the elements that they can incorporate with the Art Center into this building. And it's something that Councilmember Richens talked about earlier. I don't know if you mentioned it. Sorry, I got up and walked away. But that using this city-owned property to build buildings that we can use for our utilities, since we control the utilities in downtown, I think that is a great asset that we can leverage. So I'm in support of writing the letter, of a preliminary letter.
Okay. Any comments?
Yeah, I'm going to be in opposition. Big surprise, right? We're now talking about our downtown area, and there's certainly some interesting elements to this. I would gladly give up my parking if this were market rate housing, or if this were a true mixed use, but it's not. It's government subsidized low-income housing, and particularly right off our light rail, right in the center of downtown that we're hoping to activate with one university for sure, a second one hopefully getting ready to sign a letter of intent, right in an area where we shoot off fireworks off of the tops of buildings, and we're looking to do a project like this right there. I think there, while the Tempe project, I haven't had the opportunity to look at it. I've seen some photos of it, and it looks interesting, and I would probably support this in another area. This particular site, I think, holds out for better potential in the future. It's also going to be age-restricted. The rules have changed. The one in Tempe was 55 and older. By the way, the one in Tempe is also surrounded by university students, market-rate housing, a completely different environment than what's in downtown Mesa right now.
I don't think this is the core folks who are really going to help activate a downtown. So I'm in no rush to make that happen. I think there are better opportunities. Put this in a different location, I might be more agreeable to it. Thank you.
Councilman Higgins?
I would tend to agree with the Vice Mayor that I think this is key property that I would like to not, I would totally give up my parking space and walk easily much further for luxury condos across from my $110 million art center. I'm looking at these universities. Our Economic Development Department has just done an amazing job, and we're going to have all sorts of great announcements very soon, I hope. I want Mesa to be known as the liberal arts mecca west of the Mississippi. In order to do that, we not only need the universities to move in, we're going to have student housing, we have to have housing for the professors that are going to move here, because everybody, of course, wants to move to Mesa when they come visit. Support staff, all those people, and what a great spot to have that type of development. I agree. I don't think we need any more subsidized housing in the downtown. We need that housing that will get my residents in Lascentis going, you know what? I want to move to downtown Mesa because it's a cool, hip, happening place. You know, subsidized housing isn't going to do that. So I want that other thing that is going to bring the people to want to move to downtown Mesa, that want to work, jump on light rail if they work in Phoenix, that type of activity. So I'm not in support of this at all.
Thank you.
I'm really torn and conflicted by this because I absolutely agree with Councilman Richens that I love both projects, and I love people who stretch. And when I first saw this, I saw where they proposed to put it, I said, wow, that's a stretch. And I love that because, you know, they walked in and specifically knew that they were going right into the heart of something. That's a bold move. I love the fact that they want to do something different. My challenge with this is a little bit different, and it has to do with what I would call ripeness. Even great projects sometimes really come before, I think, or are put out in a place where maybe they're not ripe. And that's the feeling I get here. And there's a couple reasons for that. Number one, I sort of saw when we were talking about the downtown central plan, one of the things that impressed me most about that, or the central main plan, I mean, that got me really going was the vision that the consultant had for what I would call the city square, that block, that government mall area. And that's the area bounded by Center and Centennial and Main Street and First, where the city owns everything except for the old Jack in the Box site. I think we can do something extremely unique and special in there, which would include eliminating Pepper Place and turning that into something. I don't know exactly what that is. There have been some ideas thrown out through IMESA, and I don't think that that's a pipe dream that we could create. And eventually that could include private housing, some of that. If I think that this is, in my mind, this is a great, while it may be a great project, it may be a little bit more premature because some of the alternative ideas, including what the ultimate use on the old Jack in the Box site, have not really been given a chance to fully develop. And I'm not looking at a Site 17 kind of a thing where we just let it sit there for 20 years. But I think in the next year, especially through the IMESA process, you're going to see some pretty wild ideas. We saw that just with the Mayor's Youth Committee. I was amazed at some of the ideas that came out of the Mayor's Youth Committee. It's incredible what high school students do when you don't, you know, they have no boundaries to begin with. But when their imagination has no boundaries, they came up with some pretty cool stuff. I just don't think that this area, this site, this what do we call it, the city mall or the city block or whatever, I think there's a great idea that can happen that hasn't yet been allowed to fully develop. And if we move ahead, I think it's just premature. You know, next year, this may be the perfect project for this. After we've vetted some of the ideas and we've talked and we've envisioned and we've dreamed a little bit, and we get to the point where we say, okay, those were great dreams, but now it's time to move forward. I just think this is a little bit ahead of its time, and that's why I have trouble giving the false impression that I would support this at this time, because I just can't. Because I think
a different location would work.
Yeah, and I think there's something bigger for that entire area where we're talking about all the parking going somewhere or somewhere else, and we create something really special in that city block. And if we do that, if we do this, that potential completely changes. And I would not want to do that at this time. Next year, I may have a completely different view of that. So I would not support going forward at this time for that reason. Alex.
Thank you, kind mayor. I support moving forward. Thank you.
So you got your direct. See, we counted that time too. go ahead and prepare the letter, and we'll have a lot more discussion on this later.
Thank you very much.
And one of the things that we'd like need to look at is that eliminating those parking. Where would those go to? You still have cars that have to be parked. So we'll talk about that. Hopefully later. Okay. All righty. Let's take about a 5-minute break if we can. Let's take a 7-minute. Let's come back at 20 after. If we could, before we move on. Next item is here presentation. Discuss an update on the community facilities district. Scotts.
Mayor.
Dave Scotts.
Mayor. Vice Mayor.
Scott.
My other brother, Scott. No,
yeah, I know. That's why I said Scotts. Okay.
Mayor.
Good morning.
Mr. Rigby and Mr. Boy, we even have Rigby and Ruby. That's pretty close.
Perfect. Well,
good things run in pairs, right, I guess. Good morning, Mayor, Council. We're here to talk about the Community Facilities District, or commonly known as CFDs. We were last here in 2008, which I think some of you were there in 2008, but most of you probably were not, where we first discussed Community Facilities District. So we thought we'd provide just a brief primer about CFDs as some of the developers out there are considering them for Mesa. I'll just quickly run through this, and you can jump in and ask me questions as you see need, because I know we had a busy morning. They're a special purpose district within the boundaries of the city. They're a separate political subdivision. Typically governed by the mayor and council sitting as the board of directors of the district. Among their other powers, the district does have the authority to levy property taxes and or assessments, and they were established back to 1988. Before I move on, Scott Ruby is our bond counsel who's been assisting us as we evaluate community facility districts applications. Some of the merits of CFDs provide tax-exempt financing for infrastructure, and that encourages growth and annexations and for development to pay for itself, opportunity to encourage landowners in those developing areas. We'll talk about it a little bit here in a minute. Working in concert with the city to meet the city's vision, goals, and objectives. Sometimes you hear about performance-based projects. These can be performance-based CFDs. Evaluate CFDs, does the development warrant the opportunity to use this financial vehicle that the city can provide? One thing I would add is they're separate. This is the financing arm of development separate from the development entitlement process. So they're not generally coincide with the planning process. Important infrastructure can be financed without impacting limited city resources. And a great example is the Mesa Gateway area. When we did the Gateway plan about 3 or 4 years ago, one of the challenges was identifying all the infrastructure needs out there and understanding that the city probably couldn't do it all. And if we were to try and do it all, it would take a long, long time, and development would be curtailed by that. So an opportunity where CFDs come into play is developers, generally in large master plan communities such as the Eastmark project out in East Mesa, could utilize this to finance some of the development that needs to go in to encourage that type of development. It does finance public infrastructure, so any infrastructure that's financed through a CFD is public infrastructure, and ultimately will turn over to the city upon completion, inspection, and warranty. And then one item is limits the city's financial liability, so the city bonding capacity ratings are not typically impacted. But as we get into those, we structure those in any type of development agreement or agreement that to further limit that impact. These are just some of the items that can be financed. Pretty straightforward. The last item is operation maintenance costs paid by a tax levy. That's about 30 cents per $100. You know, it sounds great, and it does produce some revenue to cover some of the O&M, but usually doesn't cover the full cost of a master plan development for the O&M that the city will have to ultimately take over. I'm going to give an opportunity for Mr. Ruby to kind of comment on this slide here, talking about infrastructure.
Mayor, members of council, Scott Ruby. The CFD is an infrastructure device, infrastructure financing device. It's done through the issuance of three types of bonds, although revenue bonds has not been an option in any of the CFDs that I'm too familiar with, because it would require the CFD to levy charges and fees, which is not typically the case. But it does provide infrastructure financing through the issuance of general obligation bonds, which, like your general obligation bonds, are supported by an ad valorem property tax levied on the taxable property within the district. And then the other financing vehicle is assessment bonds. Those bonds are a bond supported by a specific monetary lien placed against the benefited parcel. So if you had a residential subdivision of 200 lots and you were financing their street, you would allocate that street probably a 1/200th to each lot, levy that finite dollar amount, and the person would pay that much in the way they pay their taxes, because this could also, the assessment bill could appear on the tax bill. They would finance it, you know, by payment of taxes twice a year. Again, it will be on the tax bill, or we probably would push towards trying to get these types of assessment bills on the tax bill. The GO obligation would be on the tax bill. So when they receive your tax bill, if you've ever looked at it, you see a number of jurisdictions that are levying taxes upon your parcel. This would be another one. The Community Facilities District would have its own line item.
Just a simple reminder of what the process is. Back in 2008, we adopted a policy. The council adopted a policy that set apart the guidelines to lead developers as they submit applications to the city. The application received by the city to date, we received one formal application. That is from the DMB group regarding the former Mesa Proving Grounds, now called Eastmark. That's been going through an evaluation with the city right now for the last year and a half as we evaluate their performance and for their feasibility of their development. If council decides to move forward with CFDs, we'd be coming in the near future to come back to the council to discuss that development proposal to use Community Facilities District, and that'll then be evaluated by the council. If the council were to agree to move forward, they would adopt a development agreement or approve a development agreement. That then moves into the next process, which is project financing of the district. The council would step back and then form a district and call itself as the district board. And then you would consider projects within that proposal for financing to move forward. And then you go through an issuing of bonds and the actual construction of those improvements. And then there'll be ongoing administration requirements for the city to take part in. Reminder, back in 2002 was our first CFD. To date, we have never done a CFD within the city. It was identified in the Gateway Strategic Plan as a key tool to be used for future financing of critical infrastructure. And to date, we've had several inquiries, and one formal one was received in 2010, which is the Eastmark property.
Now, hey, Scott, you said the city has never, go back has never authorized the creation of actual CFD. Now, just to clarify that, when you say you've received several inquiries and stuff, isn't part of our development agreement, though, with DMB and with Gaylord, for example, specifically contemplated and agreed that the city would create that? I know it hasn't been created, but I think we're parsing.
Yeah,
I don't want to give the wrong message here and just say that there's been inquiries. We actually have an agreement that we will establish to establish.
Correct.
Well, that's a big difference than just saying we've received inquiries. We have, this council, because we had this discussion 3 years ago, when we were looking at the Gaylord Development Agreement. And that Gaylord Development Agreement and the DMB, which is why we're here today, specifically contemplates that we would establish the CFD. Am I incorrect on that?
No.
No, I'm not correct, or no, I'm not incorrect.
You are
double negative.
You are correct.
I am correct. So, I just want to make sure that this is not just in passing. We have addressed this issue before, and I remember we went through the CFD 101, and we voted when we approved that development agreement. That was not a hidden item. That was an item that was very much on the open, that we discussed ad nauseum, it seemed like, to understand what was going on, and we approved that.
Now, if I recall, that CFD was a little unique, and it was not, did it include the, I'm trying to remember the nature of that one, of the character was of the improvements. Was it infrastructure?
No.
Or was it the?
Well, there was more than one CFD.
Yeah, there,
two. Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
DMB contemplates at least two CFDs.
Right.
One for the commercial aspects, which is up in the north, and which covers the Gaylord development, the convention center, and the other improvements there. The one that they're currently submitted is for the residential portion.
Yeah, so actually what this is just the second step of what we have already, this is the implementation of the concept, or is this completely separate?
No,
this is completely separate.
Let
me back off.
Yeah.
As it relates to Mesa Proving Grounds, we contemplated CFDs as a tool that would be used out there.
Absolutely.
Let me put it that way.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Correct. That's correct.
And we approved, this council approved that concept. And not only that concept, we approved that tool, that mechanism in the development agreement. What we're saying now is that we're simply implementing a concept and a tool that was approved. It's not the specific one, but this is not new for Mesa Proving Ground. This is not a discussion that we're hearing for the first time as it relates to the use of CFD in that general project.
As part of the development agreement for the Gaylord project, there was a CFD part.
Okay,
of that.
Yeah, so that's what I'm getting at. This is not new in that area.
No, yeah, but let me go a little bit further. We had discussions about the concept that CFDs would be a tool.
Right.
They'd be used in other parts of the over general, or what are we calling it, Eastmark development. At that point, it was the Mesa Proving Grounds development, as those specific units came to us.
And that's what I wanted to get
at. That was a tool we had talked about.
Yeah, this is not a new concept or a new issue for us. It has been discussed before, both specifically as it related to Gaylord and generally as it related to Mesa Proving Ground. Donna?
Mayor, that's correct, but the council will still have to go through
the approval
process.
I understand what you're saying, but I don't want to think that somehow this is something brand new that we've never talked about, because we have. Okay, all right.
I think the difference on this one will be is most likely we'll actually go through for the full formation of the district approval.
Well, it's not a difference. It's just that we've gone to the next stage.
Yes.
That we can't. We're doing it.
We anticipate
just talking about
when Gaylord's ready to move forward, we'd move forward with the formal formation.
So, I mean, if Gaylord had been built, we would have already approved their
Correct.
CFDs.
Correct.
Okay, but they haven't. So, okay. All righty.
Mayor, we're descending from 30,000 feet down to 10, down to 5, down to ground level. That's the scenario.
In a controlled landing.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
So, again, the one that we have from Eastmark right now is that for 2,300 acres, which is generally the residential portion of the development. So I'm going to provide Mr. Ruby an opportunity to talk about the district board's ongoing responsibilities when we go through with a CFD.
Because that's what the council serves as.
Correct.
Yes, Mayor, members of council, you will sit as the CFD governing board, which you have to put on a different hat. You have to serve in that capacity with respect to the CFD's activities. Those activities are primarily centered around building infrastructure and issuing bonds. In the case of most of what we anticipate happening in DMB and other CFDs, you won't be in charge of the actual construction of the infrastructure. The developer will carry through on that effort, and we will simply reimburse or acquire that infrastructure after bonds are issued. The issuance of bonds is in itself a task where you have to examine the feasibility of that bond issuance and consider the ramifications both on the district and on the city as a whole. Those activities, once a bond is issued, include having to, on an annual basis at a minimum, adopt a budget for the district, like much like you do your own city budget, maybe far less complicated than that. You can do it in like two meetings. And then you also have to comply with the tax-exempt covenants that the district makes with respect to maintaining tax exemption on the bonds it's issued. So that process has become a little more intense because of the IRS's involvement in this, in that activity or in that auditing process, but not uncommon to what you do as a city. So envision yourself as really a miniature city inside the city, but you had to behave in that capacity.
All right. And that's essentially, we wanted to provide a background on the Community Facilities District and give you an update on that, where we stand.
Okay. Councilman Finter?
As stated, supported in the past and currently support the approach of CFDs. That's, you know, when we talk about the area out there, what's it called? I'm getting used to the new name.
Eastmark.
You know, a blank canvas, the sole owner is the individuals that have come to us and said, and any future property owners will be duly notified, and they have the due diligence. But I've heard talk about using these CFDs in other parts of the town and different things. That's a whole different project. I mean, whole different view for me personally. So when you try to retroactively or go back on to folks, and it might not be 100% agreeance. So I support how this is going, but if there's any change or any different application, I would have a different opinion down the road. So thank you.
Thank you, Vice Mayor.
I've also been a strong supporter of CFDs. I think it's, I mean, clearly the purpose of establishing a CFD, there's some downsides to this. I mean, a CFD is still a taxing mechanism in order to support infrastructure. And historically, we have done that by going to the voters citywide and passing bonds to put in new parks, fire stations, roads, whatever needed to be built. These bonds are going to be paid for and utilized in a very specific area. And yet at the same time, the folks who are in this area are also going to be asked to vote on citywide bonds, correct? So we need to be judicious in how we do this. And even more importantly, we need to, the reason to do this is so that you can build that infrastructure bigger, better, and faster than you would on traditional financial mechanisms. So we can't settle for mediocre here. If we're going to approve a CFD, and one of the reasons we discussed a CFD in what's now the Eastmark area, and whenever we're going to discuss these in future areas, it's that whatever's going to happen there needs to be better than we've seen in the city thus far. It needs to really be a legacy development where the folks who are paying not only the debt service on these bonds, but debt service on the bonds for the city as a whole, they need to feel that they're getting a value from that. So when we look at this, I think it behooves the applicants to come forward and demonstrate to us, and when they say we finally want to have the CFD done, how this project is going to be a legacy. How is this project going to be better than what we expected? How are they going to demonstrate an added value by having this CFD? But it's a good mechanism for growth paying for itself.
Okay. Councilman Richards.
Just as a reminder, how does our secondary property taxes that we use to pay for other things fit into this equation?
There's two taxes levied by a CFD. There's the 30-cent O&M tax, which is also on the secondary rolls, ironically, and that is used for operation and maintenance of the district and some of the infrastructure. And then there's a second secondary tax that would be levied to support the bonds. And like your general obligation bond tax rate in the city, it too is unlimited as to rate or amount, meaning you have to levy whatever amount is necessary in order to pay the bonds, regardless of rate. And so it is a separate taxing district, and so what you have as a tax rate for the city overlaps what the CFD tax rate is. In this case, if there was a $3 rate for bonds and 30 cents for O&M, that $3.30 tax rate would simply be in addition to all of the other ad valorem property taxes levied on that property.
Okay.
So what that means, though, is that this board will be approving those rates. So they'll be really, the way I look at it, it's a secondary property tax rate and then the CFD property tax rate. And so that's just something you'll probably want to take into consideration.
What's the, I guess the thing that would I would want to make sure of is that there is complete transparency going in. These are like HOA fees in many ways. They're super HOA fees on steroids.
Well, yeah, I was gonna say.
On steroids. Because
yeah.
They're property tax. They're levied. They're included in the tax bill. They're a great way to finance, but what you're doing is you're passing on the cost of financing to those people who directly benefit from the financing, and it's not included in the price of their house. It's spread over many years.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I just want to make sure that, and I don't know, are there any requirements or anything in CFD or in state law that requires some sort of extra disclosure or in the real estate report? I know they're included in the real estate report, mm-hmm. but is that the only additional disclosure that's required, or are there anything other than that that's required to being in this district? Or is this just like being in the flood control district?
Mayor, it's hopefully more transparent than that, or at least more obvious than that. It will be in title reports. It will be in the real estate report and all of that. But in addition to that, one of the elements of the development agreement that is always entered into between the city, the CFD, and the developer is a disclosure requirement, a disclosure to the residents of that jurisdiction what exactly can happen to them because they're in a CFD, and it will specifically articulate that we can levy a tax 30 cents for O&M, that we can levy a tax for general obligation bonds, and going into the project we have an expectation that that tax rate will not exceed, and we probably state a rate in there, although again we know what the assessed valuations, how it's really right. An amount. And then lastly, we talk about assessment bonds, which really are not a secondary tax, but they have, like an HOA fee, the equivalent burden on the property owner, where they have to pay semi-annually their assessment. All of that's in a disclosure statement that is signed by the resident. I will tell you that it's in the stack of papers when they close their house that, you know, they're flipping just the corners on. In other jurisdictions, you know, I've had companies suggest that we make that disclosure document on red paper or something like that so it stands out. I mean, they all battle with that same issue.
The only difference is that then when they get mad 3 years later, they just remembered, yeah, I signed something on red paper. I had no idea what it was. It was weird that it was on red paper. Doesn't change the fact they forget it.
I think that's exactly right. And the other thing, obviously, you have to consider is they won't be particularly discerning between your role as a council member and your role as a board yeah. member, and so you're going to hear the complaints or the accolades in both those capacities.
Well, you know, like the vice mayor said, if something special is created, and if there's value that's identified, then it's well worth the price we pay. Mm-hmm. And so I think I think the reason why I'm supportive of this process at Eastmark is the developer we have, and I would hope that, you know, this is a leap of faith in some ways, but I think DMB has shown through its history that they truly are a legacy developer, and unless they take a sudden right turn away from what they've done for the past 20 plus years, which,
and we'll
looking
let them
know back it. There, and I don't anticipate that because I know the people well and I see their track record. But that's still a leap of faith. We don't know what's going to be in 5-10 years, but we do know the people we're dealing with have a track record of quality, of signature projects, of projects that elevate a community. So I would hope that that's what would make it all worthwhile. Councilman Richens.
Now, this is a generic conversation about community facility districts and how they work, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, and it comes up though because we do have some
because we have
yeah.
a
we do have some
proposal.
Specific ones coming up.
Well, just some more generic questions. Why wouldn't we consider or would what are the things that would prevent us from considering some of our other community facilities in this kind of mechanism? So, you know, parks and libraries or the art center or these different things. Why? How would those work, and why would those be a good or not good idea to include in some kind of citywide community facilities district that would have its own kind of authorities?
Well, citywide would be more like a general obligation bond. But are you talking about a specific area of the city?
Well, no. I'm just trying to understand the difference between doing it in a specific area. And like, because I knew where I grew up in California, they had community facilities districts. Yeah, for parks and libraries, and they were combined into their own kind of management.
And,
so I'm just trying to understand how that
explains state law. That Arizona is not real keen on special assessment districts.
No, and you probably lived in
California's famous for them. So.
Yeah,
they are. For Mellory.
Well, it was the result of Proposition 13.
Right. Yeah.
Proposition 13, everybody championed, Arizona's Proposition 13. These are the unintended consequences of Proposition 13. Plus, I had to go through the public schools there. So.
Yeah, with respect to a CFD's boundaries, you normally have parcelized an area or designated an area within your city as particular, as a benefited parcel, as a benefited area, and the CFD usually has a kind of a master plan. It wraps around a master plan for a particular area. If you went citywide, the manager's right, it then becomes, and there are cases to say, notwithstanding you call it a CFD, it really is a city, and it counts in your debt limits and voter obligations, et cetera. So the rationale here is that this is just a particular area within your community that is particularly benefited by the improvements proposed and or financed by that area. In fact, our state law requires that anything financed by a CFD be principally or primarily benefiting to the CFD residents and property.
So how is a CFD different than a business improvement district? Or a downtown improvement district?
If I can just finish up on the CFD, there are a list of infrastructure items that you can actually build, and public buildings is one of them. So if for some reason the area were large enough, maybe there would be a branch library, a fire station, or something else that was included in the financing of a CFD. With respect to when you say business improvement district, if I can lop off business and just tell you about improvement districts are cities can form those, and once again, they are a designated area that is designated as benefiting from a particular improvement. CFDs can issue assessment bonds, which are really improvement district types of bonds. In fact, they incorporate the very same statutes. They levy a dollar lien against the benefited property and the amount of their benefit. So there, in that sense, there is no difference between those two financing vehicles, albeit one is executed by the CFD, and in the case of an improvement district, it's executed by the city. There is one key difference, however, and that is in an improvement district executed and created by the city, in the event the person doesn't pay their assessment lien, the property, you enter into a foreclosure process where the property is sold. If it cannot be sold, that property is struck off to the city, and the city must, out of its general fund, allocate or pay that delinquency. So in an improvement district, there is a contingent liability on the general fund of the city. In a CFD, there is no contingent liability with respect to the city. If a person doesn't pay their assessment, the property is sold. If it cannot be sold, then it goes into default, it being the bonds, because there is no payment. Now, that presumes quite a few things. Number one, we structure all those deals with a reserve fund. Number two,
assume a certain
collections
less than 100%.
I mean, we're getting kind of into the weeds of how we try to we conservatively structure these bond issues, anticipating, that there might be some hiccups in the road. And we do that with general obligation bonds, albeit not a reserve fund, but we don't take the bond issue all the way up to the last dollar of tax that we expect to be generated. We back it off to assuming a 95% collection rate. So there's a number of little things we do to make sure that we can overcome the bumps in the road.
Now, in an improvement district, if there's multiple property owners, it requires some kind of vote of the property owners. A CFD, in this instance, we have a single developer. In forming a community facilities district where there's multiple property owners, does it require a vote like an improvement district would?
There are two different processes that where the property owners and or voters are involved. The one is the formation of the actual district, and the other is the issuance of bonds. In the case of an improvement district at the city level, there is an opportunity by the people to be included in that district to protest it out, i.e., they come in and they say, I don't like the district, and if 50 plus 1% don't like it, it's gone. That's the improvement district. In the case of a CFD, with respect to formation, you are required to have an election of all the qualified electors, registered voters, and property owners within that district. In the statutes do provide, however, that in the event that there are no qualified electors, it's simply a property owner vote. And in the event of a waiver by the property owner of the formation election, you can immediately form it without an election. Okay, so that district can be formed without an election if there is a waiver agreement signed by the property owner.
By 100% of the property owners?
100%, okay. Yeah.
And now how does a vote go to a property owner who's a corporate entity?
Landowner votes are by acre. In the case of a CFD, every 1/7 of an acre receives a vote. So that what happens in a corporate scenario.
So an LLC of some kind, do they get?
We just have a corporate resolution issued by the LLC that says so-and-so is, you know, on our behalf can vote for us, okay. And so they vote.
Okay.
Now, when you get to the bond side, interestingly, you know, each bond issue has a different requirement. In the case of levying a tax, an ad valorem tax, so this goes to both the O&M and the general obligation bonds, the statutes require that there be an election, again, of qualified electors and property owners. Again, if there are no qualified electors in there, you are just a property owner election. And the statute does not allow you to waive that election. So you actually, although you may have formed the district without an election, in order to authorize bonds, you would have to have an election, which happens in virtually every case, of the property owner / developer who votes in favor of it, both the O&M tax and the bonds.
Thank you.
And in the case of assessment bonds, it mirrors the city process where 50 plus 1 can vote it out, but there, too, you can have a waiver agreement where they waive that right.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Stay tuned.
When do you anticipate the specific ones coming before us?
I think we'll see the first one would be Eastmark. Probably the next few weeks we'd be coming back to you.
Next few weeks meaning 2 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks?
Yes,
probably second half of...
From middle of March, right?
Middle of March, second part of March.
So the next 3 weeks or so.
Yeah. And then, Mayor, just to kind of alert you, there is a very systematic sequence to these events, and so we will be bothering you probably every council meeting / once you form a CFD, every CFD meeting in a pretty routine sequence for probably a number of months.
And the CFD meetings will take place like any of our special, like the Housing Authority. We'll just do them as a
like
special
adjourn
meeting.
Adjourn from your council meeting.
Or else do it the first thing and then go to the CFD,
yeah,
but whatever.
It, yeah.
It'd take place just like that.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay.
All righty.
Thanks.
Thank
you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Okay. Here presentation discuss fiscal year capital improvement program. Just interesting how for some reason each agenda item we keep fewer and fewer people.
Not as many people interested in this particular topic.
Why don't we have that option? I really, why do they get to get up and go and we don't? Candace.
Thank you. Good morning. Good news is this is an informative presentation. I'm not going to ask you to make any decisions this morning, and I'm not going to ask you for any direction. So you can just sit back and listen.
Exactly.
So the reason why we're here today we are here because of the city charter. The city charter requires that we actually produce a CIP document each year by March 1st. This is problematic for us each year because basically we're not done with our CIP process. We're in the middle. So we stop our CIP process, focus on the document, get it out by March 1st, and then continue our CIP process.
This year it's a little more problematic for us because we are live with our performance budgeting module of our City Edge project. That's good news. The bad news is that we are still working with our vendor to build and produce these new documents. So this March 1st publication will not come from the new software. So it will be coming from offline. So we are producing that. What that means is that the document you will be receiving will look different than it has in the previous years that you've received on March 1st. What we've handed out is an example of what we're going to be submitting to you next Thursday, which is March 1st. It's only 1 week away. Excuse me. It will really be a list of projects as we have identified so far. Those are projects that you've either seen last year or have been identified throughout the year as mid-year type projects that have come forward to you. That's what's in our CIP charter version publication. We won't have projects by page with all of the detail that we've had in the last couple of years, but all projects will be submitted on here and we will meet our charter requirements. So we just want to kind of give you an example of what those expectations are for next Thursday. The next book you get will be you're familiar with the capital improvement program, but for anyone who has not heard about it, we also refer to it as CIP. So if you hear us mention CIP, it refers to the capital improvement program. It is a multi-year plan for scheduling and funding our capital infrastructure needs. Even though the council adopts the first year of the plan, each project comes before the council individually during that year for individual approval. The documents that you receive through the course of the CIP process are three. You actually receive three different documents. The first one is the March 1st book that we talked about. It contains only the projects that are funded with our current bond authorization, so it does not involve any future authorizations we may need. It also includes the projects that are funded with grants and or the cash, the pay-as-you-go type of projects. The next document that you receive, which is in the May timeframe, is our preliminary CIP plan document. This document takes the projects from the March 1st and then adds all of the future bond authorizations that we anticipate to have in the outer years. And those are the ones you see in May. The final document is after the final CIP adoption in June. We come out with a document in August or September, which includes all projects that have been identified and funded in the adopted CIP plan. It also includes our carryover funding that you don't see up until that point, which are projects from our 11-12 fiscal year that we were not able to complete. We need to carry over the funding and the expenditures into the 12-13 fiscal year. So that's type of the progression of our CIP document. Where we are today. So we've called this a preview, not an overview, because you're previewing where we are in the process so far this year. So just to give you an idea, excuse me, of where the funding comes for our CIP program. The bulk of it comes from various types of bonds. Just under 92% of our currently identified projects are funded with some type of a bond. The federal, state, and regional funding there in the green is a bulk of those are Falcon Field projects and or if we have any stimulus projects left. So you see that's smaller over these years now that the ARRA money has been used. Okay. We thought we'd take this opportunity, because bonding is the way that we do fund our projects, to give you an overview of where we are so far on the last bond elections that we had. So our last general obligation bond was in 2008. November of 2008 was our election. We had public safety bonds and transportation streets bonds for those. And you can see where we've looked here is what our authorization is, where we expect to spend from inception to the end of this fiscal year, what a remaining authorization is. Over the years, we do realize some savings in some of these projects based on our original 2008 estimated cost of projects. As we realize savings, we take those savings, we still have that authorization, and we apply those to the necessary projects still remaining. We have applied some of those at this point. So if you look at that last column where it says unallocated to projects as of today, okay, unallocated does not mean that it's just sitting out there waiting for a project to come along. It means that at this point in the process, we have defined certain projects to use the savings on, and we have identified possible projects for the remainder of those savings. These are not new projects. It's projects that were previously identified. It allows us to use current authorization rather than having to go out and receive more authorization to do these projects. That $11 million you see sitting in the transportation streets does have a list of projects that we have currently identified for that funding, but they are not finalized. We're still working on them. So when you receive your March 1st publication, you will not see those in that publication.
And we didn't want to presume that either. We've had a conversation with council about what to do with some of the savings in transportation. There's additional savings. So what we'll do is in a presentation during the budget process, we're going to come to you and say, okay, here are some projects. So we can have that anticipation before we publish the final CIP. So we're saying this is where we have to meet the charter requirements, but we know we've got this period of time when we do our budget review with the council and we can make presentations, and that's when you'll get the presentations on these projects.
Yeah.
These savings are complicated things.
Well, when you see the list of when we came to you with savings before in transportation, we weren't sure. We had a longer list of projects to do than we had savings. So when we come back, you're going to see a lot of things that are familiar to you. It's not going to be, and part of the savings has been a result, too, that transportation staff has been very successful in getting regional dollars that we had not anticipated previously. And so that allows us to stretch our bond funds further than we had expected even a year ago. And so now we have the flexibility that we have some additional geo bonds. So that'll be a discussion that'll come up early in the process, and we'll say, okay, here are those savings, here are the projects, and then we can have that conversation about what the priorities of council are.
Our last utility bond authorization was approved in 2010, so it's a more recent authorization. So when we look back at where we are on that particular authorization, you'll see, for example, if you look at wastewater, our estimated expenditures through June of this year is zero. That does not mean that we're not working on wastewater projects. That means that we still had authorization from our 2006 election that we're still using. So we've been able to make those last a little bit longer, and we don't need to start using the 2010 authorization until 12-13.
Thanks, Candace. Councilmember Higgins has a question.
Thanks, Mayor. Really quick question, and maybe it's to Chris, too. The 2006 authorization didn't come with the voter-approved secondary property tax.
This is the utility bond.
Sorry. Okay. It's been a long day.
Yes. So if you go back.
But they were correct.
Thank you.
Revenue bonds.
Revenue bonds.
Yes, they were revenue bonds. These are utility revenue bonds.
Thank you very
I should
much.
Put that. So if you look at that, when you're looking at the estimated column for this year of what we expect to spend, this is just out of our 2010. We're just trying to give you a glimpse of this is the last election we have, and how do we manage that bond authorization, making sure that we only use that when it's needed, making sure that we're managing the prior authorizations first before we go into the 2010 authorization. So that's why you see in wastewater $0. We actually are spending money in wastewater, but it's from the 2006.
Right. So it's important for us to spend the older bond funds first before we move to the new stuff. So, and then just quickly, Mayor and Council, what this also kind of gives us a sense of is where we are. You know, we set up a program. We'll say when we issue that, or we go out to the voters for a bond program, we'll say this is a 2-4 year program, whatever. Mm-hmm. As you can see in some of these categories, we're getting near the end. Public safety being one of those, and so there'll be a question about you know, we've got a lot to do this next year, so there's a lot. We're spending, we still have a lot of activity, but you know, when is the timing? And maybe one of the things we want to talk about are future capital project purposes that we may have in public safety, and start thinking about okay, when would be the next time we would go to the voters. Same thing in transportation, mm-hmm. Utilities may be the same way. We believe that at least and that $16 million is a lot to spend in 1 year. So we think we've got plenty to do this year. Mm-hmm. There may be some additional savings. But we do need to start thinking about the conversation. What happens next? We know the IMESA conversation, which should be coming to council next Monday. So it's all those things have to be discussed about council's comfortable and timing of when we do bond elections.
Yeah, Council.
That's a great point. I've been watching and waiting when you hear talk of the schools doing a $250 million bond, what we've done, where are we going. I really worry about sticker shock and timing and different things, and so it'd be kind of interesting to see that all come together as a, you know, to the council.
Sure. Oh, no, and that's what you'll start seeing. Yeah.
And that's the other thing in the March 1st book document. What you'll see is what the current schedule for these projects are for the remainder of this bond authorization. Again, we're in process, so it's not the final schedule. Schedules could move around. But in the March 1st book, you can see this, the remaining authorization here and how that's scheduled out and which fiscal years we currently have that scheduled to see when we would expend that authorization. And then just as another note, as a reminder, when we say we're talking about remaining authorization, that is not money in the bank. That's authorization for us to go out. We don't actually go out and sell the bonds except for that one particular year. What our needs are for that one particular year is what we sell. So we're always managing the cash as well as managing the authorization.
Vice Mayor?
Briefly, in these future discussions, I want to reiterate that we need to take a close look on how these bonds tie into our economic development efforts, mm-hmm. particularly on the Gateway area. We have a lot of need in that area. I keep reading story after story about our successes here, from Able Engineering to heading toward 1.6 million passengers out of the Gateway area, which is a 33% approval over last year, potentially for this next coming year. We have First Solar broken ground. Hopefully it'll open up in January of next year. But we've run out of capacity to do another First Solar. Now that's on the revenue side with water, wastewater streams. But it illustrates the fact that if we are going to continue the success we've had over the past few years in bringing high-quality jobs into Mesa, we need to make an investment on the front end in the infrastructure, particularly over in Southeast Mesa, in and around the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. So that needs to be a significant part of the discussion.
You will see that.
Thank you.
You'll see that. And there's, we still need to be very aggressive too in the downtown area. We need to go, we have our neighborhoods, we have aging infrastructure. So it's like creating that balance mm-hmm. through the whole thing, and we still have our commitments with the Riverview development too. So we have all those things that we're going to try to bring to you over the next couple of months.
Yes. Otherwise, and other than that, that's just basically what we talked about. So our calendar for CIP is to come back as the departments give their budget presentations, to also go over their list of projects that they have scheduled or that they would like to schedule over the next few years and how those roll into the strategic initiatives of the council. And June 18th is when we do a public hearing on the CIP and the final adoption of the five-year plan.
Great. Any other questions for Candace? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And one of the things, Mayor and Council, we may, I think Candace was trying to be subtle in her hint that at some point, if there's ever charter provision revisions,
yes.
this requirement of March 1st, we're not sure what it's related to. It may be. It's not a very productive
strike four words from the city charter, the budget office would be very happy and be able to more efficiently use our resources.
Well, I think one thing, you know, we've danced around certain charter issues, and I don't know that I'm prepared to go into a full-blown thing at this late date, but I think there are some specific, what I would call this is almost a technical change.
Right.
Yes.
We talked about, for example, some of our election issues, and that's where the greatest cleanup needs. With the state changing by law, by statute, when we hold our elections, it really has created somewhat of a mess in our charter, because our charter contemplates elections in March and May. And then there's just some, you know, we'll follow state law. There's just some technical changes. And maybe what we need to do is consider some technical changes on as it relates to some charter issues, and we can take care of that, which would include some cleanup.
You know, like
changing that. The dates, like when the elections are held, to comply with state law, and these things, which really are counterproductive. It's something we may want to consider, and we need to get going on it, I guess, fairly quickly. But I don't know that I would want to do a full-blown right now. Maybe after.
Yeah, it's just something we need to put on our list of.
Yeah, but there's enough cleanup items that I think might merit at least looking at that. Okay.
We would be grateful for that.
Well, okay, yeah, because we haven't, I don't think we've done that. And this city hasn't done it in years.
And you know, charter needs to be changing. I'm talking about huge policy changes. I'm just talking about cleanup to make the charter conform with reality. Mm-hmm. All righty. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Acknowledge receipt of minutes of various boards and minutes. Have a motion by Vice Mayor, second Councilmember Glover. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Yeah, Councilmember Higgins.
Yesterday morning, Mayor, I had the opportunity to go to ASU Polytechnic and partake in the ribbon cutting of their new the EOC. So it's the first emergency operating center to back up the state's operating center. And it's at the beautiful Polytechnic campus in Mesa, Arizona.
In Mesa, Arizona.
And it is way cool. You know, it's an emergency operating center, right? So it's a backup to the it's the first backup. They didn't have a backup currently for the EOC that's in down in Phoenix, and it also can do simulations and all sorts of other cool stuff. So I want to just congratulate Dr. Danny Peterson, who is the professor that's leading the charge and was instrumental.
And I had the opportunity on Monday to speak at another big event at ASU Polytechnic, which was the dedication of the new, I don't know how to describe it. It's the algae beds for the AsCaddy, which is, I'm just going to maybe pay my 50 cents in, because I'm trying to remember what the acronym meant. It's the Arizona Center for Algae Technology and Innovation. There, I got it, AsCaddy. It's pretty incredible, the stuff that's going on at Poly. It relates to algae technology, and University of Arizona now has a full-blown project inside AsCaddy, which is headquartered there. There's some exciting stuff going on there. And this thing's really cool. I mean, it's another really cool thing. Great things going on at Poly, and had the opportunity. And thank you, all those out there. The governor was even out speaking at the AsCaddy ribbon cutting. And it was funny because scissors wouldn't cut the ribbon, and the governor's going like this, and then she realizes, and only a woman would pick this up, realizes that the scissors were upside down. See, a man would never figure that out. Yeah, so she turns it because scissors cut differently, depending on whether you're right
side left-handed. Up. It was the left-handed version.
Yeah, it was basically the same thing. And, you know, when you got these big old scissors, you don't know. Boy, she turned it around and snipped the ribbon right in half, so... I was impressed.
One other thing.
Yeah.
I also, which is very fun and failed to mention, I attended the 2012 Arizona Aviation Walk of Fame, which was induction service.
Oh, thank you, because I couldn't go.
Totally,
to that.
Totally fun. And there was one Medal of Honor winner. I met recipient. I'm sorry. And he was inducted. So there were not only military aviators inducted, there were people that were critical to aviation, like I'm not going to remember their name, but they invented the bulletproof fuel tank, which was an Arizona company. No, it was a guy. I think it's James Robertson. I don't remember. But the big company, and that's in all the fuel tanks that are now today. They're the bulletproof fuel tank. So that was an Arizona inventor, which is very cool in company. And then Sergei Sikorsky, which I didn't even know was... helicopters, big helicopters, from 1925 in New York, which is kind of cool, in Connecticut. And he is an Arizona resident, so he was inducted too. So very fun, a lot of great people, and just a great event. So a shout-out to the CAF, Commemorative Air Force Museum, for doing another great thing.
And the CAF is such a big, good part of our community. Yep. They do all sorts of things out there and bring a lot of... they're just a great part. Yep. We appreciate them. Okay. Mr. Brady.
Excuse me. Just remind the council, we have a council meeting on Monday, and that will be preceded with a study session. So we'll check on the start time for that meeting. I believe that's when, like we mentioned just a minute ago, we'll have the report from the IMESA committee will be that evening before the council meeting. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Get us out of here.
There's nothing else. Councilmember Glover has a motion to adjourn. Councilmember Higgins has seconded. Any discussion on this motion? We're adjourned. Thank you.